bus. We are on the Wheatfield Road and by the beginning of Smith's Battery.
This is where we started the tour the last time. Basically, we're going to make a huge circle in our tour, but we're going to cut some of it off because we're going to be parking on top of Devil's Den. We'll cut down some of the walking today, but this is a very, very good place to start. We're going to be seeing very shortly a four-gun battery on top of Devil's Den. The guns are misplaced, and I'll show you exactly where they were, but they belong to a New York captain by the name of James Smith. James Smith tried to put all six guns on top of Huck's Ridge, which is the top of Devil's Den, but he couldn't find room for all six guns. You needed at least 100 yards. If you wanted to crowd it in, you'd probably need at least 75 yards. He didn't have the 75 yards for a six-gun battery. So he decided, and very correctly so, to place his other two guns down here, guarding his rear. Now, these are... this is Smith's last section, or at least is what I'll be referring to it as. Now, if you look down, the muzzles of these guns have been placed very accurately. They are pointing down in something that we call slaughter pen. All right, slaughter pen is the low ground between Big Round, top of that hill, and Huck's Ridge, which ends in Devil's Den. Okay, and these guns are going to do a remarkable job that day. In fact, probably the most famous tour that was ever given on the battlefield was given in the 1960s by Dwight D. Eisenhower. You know, he lived in Gettysburg, and he took Field Marshal Montgomery on a tour of the battlefield, and there had to be 60 reporters with him taking down almost everything that he said. And he brought Montgomery down to these guns right where we're standing right now, and he said, pound for pound, these two guns probably did more damage to any Confederate regiment in Gettysburg, and he's probably right. In fact, these guns will eventually start firing canister down that gorge from about where we are here. And you could imagine, if you've ever been into Devil's Den and Slaughter Pen, you could imagine the damage that it would have ricocheting off of the rocks down there. In fact, the battle flag of the 2nd Georgia went down three times under the canister fire of these guns. That's incredible. It truly is. In fact, for about 10 minutes, these guns single-handedly kept the 44th and the 48th Alabama from rushing from the slope Big Round Top through the gorge up the reverse slope that you see on your right there into the rear of the Union position at Devil's Den. So there you're standing at a very, very important spot. When the Union soldiers would eventually withdraw from Devil's Den, they would withdraw behind these guns, and then these guns were then withdrawn, and they were then withdrawn back to the Wheatfield Road at the base of Little Round Top, where they continued to fire at the Confederates. At this point, the Confederates had been successful at Devil's Den, and we're driving the Union soldiers completely out of the woods to our right as well, which are the Rose Woods, and just on the other side of these trees is the wheat field, and the wheat field is being compromised as well. All right, so these guns did a heck of a job. All right, so we don't have to get into these again. I'll be referring to these guns a number of times when we were up there on top of that ridge line, but I just wanted to see their arc of fire, if you will. A guy by the name of Williams, Frank Williams was the section commander that was down here. But Smith would personally, you see, at one point he would give up the guns that he has on Devil's Den. One gun would be disabled during the artillery barrage that preceded the Confederate assault against the Union soldiers up there. The carriage and the wheel was broken down completely, so they took the muzzle, they strapped it to a horse, and they pulled the muzzle out. So he actually goes down as losing only three guns. But there was a point when he looked around and he saw Confederates on three sides of him and knew the jig was up, if you will. He disabled the guns. He spiked the guns. And I don't know if you know how that was done, but it's very simple. There's something called a vent pick. It's about that long. It looks like an ice pick. And they put it in the vent hole and they knock it off with a mallet. So the only way you could use them again was to rebore the hole, rebore the vent hole. You fired the gun through the vent hole. And they disabled the guns as best they possibly could, took all the implements, and Smith and his men finally withdrew back here. And then Smith was under the command of this last section. All right, so initially, when these guns were really not being fully used, there was somebody back down here kind of twiddling his thumb by Frank Williams, but Smith would actually engage the enemy with the canister. Okay? Pretty good. Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah, it's 8 replacement for all six guns. His guns are placed there by the park. They were not there at the time of the battle. They were down here. In fact, the rightmost muzzle was over the wall, about where we're standing right now. We know that for a fact. During the dedication of Smith's Battery and Monument that you see back there, General Henry Hunt was sitting with James Smith, Captain James Smith. During the invocation, as a priest stands up to bless the ground, Hunt leans over to him and said, "If you placed your guns here, I would have court-martialed you." So we know darn well that those guns weren't down there, but they're about 60 yards in front. Three guns basically faced this field in that direction. One gun was facing in that general direction, and we'll be over there a little bit later. Now, what you see in front of you does not look this way 134 and a half years ago. This was all open. In fact, if there's a portion of the battlefield that we would like to clear, and the park is considering doing it, it would be the 75 acres of woodland directly in front of you. This was all open here all the way to the Confederate battle line about a mile away. Alright, so you had this swatch out right here.
Wow.
Now that wood line to your right was the Rosewoods. That was there at the time of the battle. It wasn't as dense then as it is today. There's a reason for that. This is true for almost every woodlot on the battlefield. There's an awful lot of pasturing animals here at the time of the battle. Also, this is a wood-burning community, so everything's picked up and falls down. All right, so it was not as dense. There's not as much sapling growth in 1863 as there is today. And there's going to be a great deal of fighting going on in those woods. We'll be on those woods later. What it looked like. This is called the George White Triangular Field. It's perfectly triangular. It's 500 feet per side. It's 3 acres. It falls off 50 feet and 300 feet. So, or 50 feet and 300 yards. So, as you can see, a reasonably good and severe declivity here in front of us. Now, all these trees have been going on here at the time of the battle. Look down there. You see a wall, a stone wall, which is one of the sides of the triangle, if you will. About 100 yards further past that, by the time of the battle, there was a split rail fence. About 45 feet high. Also, there are very large boulders that you'll see also down there. We can see some of them down there, but there are more boulders down there. In fact, when the first Texas withdraws, the people saw it back in that direction. There'll be advances in that direction. Now for the Union position. We have four guns of James Smith's Battery. Like I said, you're about where the right gun was at the time of the battle. Directly behind them, and slightly over behind you and over your right shoulder, would be the 124th New York, which we call the Orange Blossoms. Up along the top of the rocks, which is the top of Devil's Den, you would have had the 4th Eli Walker's 4th Maine. And then further down, you would have the 86th New York and the 20th Indiana and the 89th Pennsylvania. Hobart Ward's Brigade constitutes the left flank of the Union Army on July 2nd. It is the largest Union brigade here in Gettysburg. I don't know if you needed that, but you know, I'm just showing off. The 2nd U.S. Sharpshooters and the 1st U.S. Sharpshooters are also a part of the of Hobart Ward's Brigade. The 2nd U.S. Sharpshooters stand down in this general area, trying to slow down what will eventually be the Confederate advance in this area. In fact, there'll be three companies, companies D, C, and G. Back into these positions and adding their strength, if you will, especially to a place called the Ledge in these woods to your right against the 3rd Arkansas. Okay? Just keep that in mind for later use. Alright, now what's going to be coming at them? This the Confederates are advancing. This is going to be an advance in echelon, meaning that the Confederates from the south will be advancing first. The Confederates further up the Confederate battle line, further to the north, will then be advancing, almost like a way of breaking upon a beach. You know, one outfit will advance, and another will advance, and another. And what we've got is we've got two brigades of Confederates that begin the advance. Evander Law's brigade and Jerome Robertson's Confederate brigade, all of Hood's. They were called Hood's Division, Hood's Texas. Actually, Alabama's Arkansas and Texas. As they start coming across the field, they take fire from about 40 cannons in some place called the Peach Orchard and the Wheatfield Road. and four more cannons from where you're standing. Smith's gun. Smith's guns are playing on them quite well. In fact, Smith said that his guns never played better upon any Confederate lines than he did against Law's Hood's division on July 2nd. As a result of this fire, two Confederate regiments, the 1st Texas, the 3rd Arkansas, will break away from their attack toward Big Round Top. These Confederates are trying to swing around the Union flank. And these are the Confederates that will attack Little Round Top, which is directly behind you. But two regiments, the 1st Texas and 3rd Arkansas, will break off and head directly in that direction toward Smith's guns. The idea of silencing these guns, if you will. It'll be the 1st Texas and the 3rd Arkansas. The 1st Texas will come across this open field. The 3rd Arkansas will not. They will pinch in about where the something called the Timbers Farm is, and they will go into the Rose Woods and engage the right of Hobart Ward's brigade, and we'll be down there a little bit later. I'll get you guys out of here pretty soon. You guys don't want to freeze. Anyway, the 1st Texas is going to go up and over that split rail fence about 100 yards past that wall. They will continue. It's at that point when the Confederates get to the base of the hill, especially down there. They're coming in generally from that direction. When they get to that point, Smith abandons his guns. The reason being, he no longer depresses barrels low enough to fire at those Confederates. So he abandons his guns, meaning that he just takes his implements and his men and goes to the rear, and about where we probably parked. It's at that point that the 124th New York comes from his right rear into the guns and takes position basically about where we are right now along this stone wall. When the Confederates start their movement forward, Van Horn Ellis, the commander of the 124th New York, tells his men to fix bayonets. When the Confederates are halfway across this field, that's when they give the command up and fire by rank. The first rank stands up and fires into the Confederates, stopping the Confederates cold. The second rank then stands up, fires another volley. That volley breaks the 1st Texas, and the Texas now starts withdrawing back across the field, back to that corner, if you will. Okay? So at this point, in fact, a member of the 124th New York said they ran like frightened sheep. It's at this point that Major Cromwell of the 124th New York is on a big gray horse. He comes riding over to Van Horn Ellis, and Ellis is toward the right of the regiment, so he's somewhere where we are right now. And he literally begs the colonel for permission to lead a countercharge against the fleeing Texans. Grudgingly, Van Horn Ellis, it's one of those James Longstreet replies, you know, with a nod of his head, you know. And with that, Ellis jumps the swamp, gets into the field, waves his sword over his head, and said, "Come on down this way, boy." And they start racing down the hill. Unfortunately, many of the Texans had rallied in the boulders that you'll see a little bit later, just on the other side of that stone wall. And they wait until the New Yorkers are halfway across this field when they begin to fire. 25% of the New Yorkers are shot down in the first volley. These guys are shot down left, right, and sideways. All right, and as well as Cromwell. Cromwell is shot off his gray horse. He falls off the back of his horse, gets wedged between two large rocks. It's at this point that Van Horn Ellis, the commander of the 124th New York, now jumps over the wall into the middle of the field and yells at his men, "Your major is down, boys." However, more problems are taking place. I said this was an in-echelon attack. We have a bunch of Georgians, 2nd, 17th, 15th, 17th, 20th, and 2nd Georgia of General Bennings, Henry Bennings Brigade. And they're coming up. They're coming up in support of these two Confederate regiments. And they will begin with those Texans at that split rail fence. When they get there, they will then fire a volley at what was left of the in and amongst the boulders down near that wall. The volley will produce a number of more casualties in the 124th New York, as well as their colonel. Cromwell was shot through the head, and they said he was dead before he hit the ground, deader than Elvis.
and his men will then withdraw back, pulling the bodies of the colonel and their major back to the comparative safety of the position you're at right now. That's the first action that takes place. Now, while this is happening, we have the U.S. sharpshooters that have been trying to hold back the 3rd Arkansas at a place called the Timbers Farm. Now, the Timbers Farm no longer stands, but if some of you did go out there, you'll see a foundation, and you can get there in various ways. The easiest way, or one of the ways, if it was a nice day, I'd do it with you. If you follow that stone wall right there in a straight line, about 250 yards, it would be on your right. Okay, so we have 3 companies of the 2nd U.S. Sharpshooters, companies B, C, and G, that slow up the 3rd Arkansas' advance, but then withdraws back into a position called the Ledge. And the Ledge is a group of rocks that are right in the middle of these woods, which are, like I said, the George Rose Woods. We'll be down there a little bit later. So the 3rd Arkansas we'll get into later, but basically the 1st Texas, by the way, gets hopelessly intermingled with the 15th Georgia. They can no longer separate the command. So the 1st Texas and the 15th Georgia will work as a unit the rest of the fight. Okay? Now I can get you on the other side of the hill out of this wind if you'd like.
What time of the afternoon is
this? The hill out of this wind.
What time is this battle?
The action begins. The Confederates begin their advance about 4 o'clock. This would have been about 4:20, 4:25. And by the way, this action precedes the action that's going on Little Round Top. There hasn't been a shot fired. In fact, there's not even a Union soldier on the hill at this point. Okay? There's a race to the hill. This is very important. Now, we have an awful lot of Confederates that are passing the flank of this position. You're going to be disappearing in a woodlot right below the base of Big Round Top with the understanding of going up and over Big Round Top to get to Little Round Top. But James Smith, the battery commander, does not know their destination. For all he knows, they're going to try to swing around, come up the gorge which we first discussed, which is called Slaughter Pen, and take his guns from the rear. Okay?
What's going on if we feel the future at this time?
Nothing.
So this is actually the beginning of the whole
this
action.
This is the action of the against Sickles line that day. Now there is some fighting. There are 5 other companies of the 2nd U.S. sharpshooters
down the Slider.
Yeah, down in the Slider farms that are picking away and slowing down the Confederates. In fact, at the Slider farm, the 4th Alabama rushes at least 3 companies of the 2nd U.S. sharpshooters down at the Slider farm with the bayonet. That's quite remarkable, you know, a bayonet charge to clear skirmishers. Well, that's basically what they were, professional skirmishers, out of a very strong position at the Slider farm. Once that happens, then 2.5 companies of U.S. sharpshooters will come up the ravine, the Slaughter Pen Ravine, if you will, and fall in and amongst the rocks of Douglas Dam, give support to the next action we're discussing, the Union support, while 3 more companies, like I said, D, C, and G, will fall back and pretty much give Ward's right flank some support. They will be.
These guys
will
be 4th.
Yes, exactly. Very good. Excellent. Let me get you guys out of the wind. But before we go that way, though, I want to show you something that, since the park is cleared, this area down here is very, very important. Nobody knows where the nose is. I'm showing you where the nose is. It's basically right down there. We'll be going up and over the nose down, I'll show you the extent of Devil's Den. It's a lot bigger than you think it is, or most people think it is. When the Confederates will charge, we're going to get into that action in just a few minutes. We're part of the 44th Alabama. Now we're going to get into this. All this will be explained to you. The 44th Alabama will be coming across the nose of the hill, trying to get to Smith's guns from this direction. Okay? If fact, the last action at Devil's Den will take place down here. The ground that you see in front of you, just off the left gun of the of Smith's guns, right here. So the action that you see here will be described, but I'm describing it from the cover to the other side of the ridge. Okay? Fourth Maine will come down here, make a bayonet charge, driving out a portion of some Georgians in the 44th Alabama, 99th Pennsylvania, which is that very modern-looking monument right behind that tree. Be the 99th Pennsylvania, be the last Union regiment out of this area, okay? And they're actually right down in the basin. Right, and what I say about that is, because when you guys come back here in the nice warm summer, I mean, you'll have weeds like this all the way up to your waist, so you won't be able to even come to this position you're standing on right now. And most of the action, like I said, the final action at the den took place down here. I just wanted you to take a good look at it. Also, the first Texas, when they were coming across the fields, were coming across basically from there. Their right flank would have been down here on this low ground. Okay? Let's get you over there and get you out of the way.
And come up on the top of the hill by Smith's Battery, overlooking Round Top.
All right, now, as I said, early on in the fight, you had the 4th Maine up here on top of this cushy high ground. Basically right behind the ridge line, right where we are. Because the main concern at this point were many Confederates advancing from that direction, from their lines west of here. However, James Smith, the battery commander, will be calling the shots around here completely. I mean, it's up to him, basically, what's going on here. At least he believes it to be. Now, as the 1st Texas advances, and there's some gunfire on his right as the 3rd Arkansas pushes into the Rose Woods, James Smith is very, very worried about the Confederates that he saw on his left going across the open fields and being engaged by the 2nd U.S. sharpshooters down near the Slider Farm. Then those Confederates disappearing in a woodlot directly at the base of the Round Top, maybe 400 or 500 yards in that direction. Now, he doesn't know that these Confederates are going up and over Big Round Top. All he knows is that Confederates have disappeared off his left flank. He's worried about the Confederates coming down this ravine. As you see here, we call it the Slaughter Pen. They come swinging up and take his guns from the reverse. So he goes over to Elijah Walker, and he says, the colonel of the 4th Maine, he says to Walker, I want you to send your men down in the low ground down there in the Marshall Grounds, set up the battle line to protect my flank and rear. Now, Walker's got a pretty nice spot where he is right here, and he's not too happy about this. He says, no way, Jose, I'm not going down there unless I'm compelled to do so. At this point, that Smith gets on his horse, goes looking for the nearest general he can find, and that happens to be Hobart Ward. And Hobart Ward comes running over here, and after it's explained to Hobart Ward, he compels the none-too-happy Elijah Walker to take his position off of this high ground. That obelisk monument down there is the monument to the 4th Maine. His right flank he places in the rocks. His left flank he pushes into the past and marshy ground. That is Plum Run as well. Into those rocks. He needs a head start in any action that he can possibly take place down here. So what he will do is he'll go over to a captain by the name of Libby, L-I-B-B-Y, and he'll take Captain Libby, take an officer or two and 70 men off of the left flank of the 4th Maine and advance them into Big Round, up the slopes of Big Round Top to give him any pre-warning or any warning of any Confederate advance in that direction. Now what has happened here, it's a good thing that Libby did that, or it's a good thing that Elijah Walker did that. After the 1st Texas has been dispatched, as they've been driven back into the Georgians, if you will, along that split rail fence, Jerome Robertson, the brigade commander, has been fighting with the 1st Texas and the 3rd Arkansas, and he calls for help. Now remember, we have a whole lot of Confederate regiments. We have 6 Confederate regiments that are going through the slider farm up and over Big Round Top. It's at this point that Jerome Robertson sends a request to Evander Law, who has now taken over divisional command because Hood has been wounded. All right? And he asks for help in this unequal contest of Devil's Den. In response, the 44th and the 48th Alabama from Evander Law's brigade will be sent to his support in exactly the position that that James Smith battery commander, the Union battery commander, feared, up the ravine, if you will. And they are going to try to take those guns from the reverse. All right? Unfortunately, they're going to run right into, first of all, they'll run into Libby's men, and then they will run into the 4th Maine. Now, Libby's men only fire a few scattered shots and start withdrawing. The 44th and the 48th Alabama follow them right to the front of the 4th Maine. When, if you were looking out this way 134 and a half years ago on that July 2nd, the 44th Alabama would be pulled further down in that direction, pretty much opposite the very large rocks that we call Devil's Den. The 48th Alabama would be right in front of it. And the 48th Alabama would get to about where that park path is, right about there, when the 4th Maine opened up on them. And it was pretty devastating. Well, the 4th Maine actually opens up both on the 44th and the 48th Alabama. The 48th Alabama, however, is only about 20 paces away from the left flank of the 4th Maine. And they exchange about a half a dozen shots at that close range. One of the immediate casualties is Elijah Walker. Elijah Walker is on his horse in that marshy ground right there, behind that truck. You know what I mean?
Perfect timing.
Never fails. Anyway. So at this point, the bullet goes into his leg. To give you an idea what a severe wound it must have been. It was 4 inches above his ankle, went right through his boot, right through his leg, into his horse, killing his horse. And the horse goes down. Man and horse goes down. He gets up, is propped up by a musket, if you will, continues to fight. He will give the order for his left flank to withdraw back into these rocks at the base of his ridge line. We're on Huck's Ridge, if you will. So, the 4th Maine has been pushed back to the base of this ridge. Again, their right flank in the rocks, the left flank just in front of you down here in the rocks, battling the 48th Alabama. Now we got a bit of a problem, however, because we have a couple of things that are happening. The Georgians, for instance, have determined to give support to what's happening on this side of the ridge. So Benning decides to start swinging his right flank in that direction, around the nose of Devil's Den, to link up to the 44th Alabama, which he starts to do. The second actually will be opposite the ravine eventually, then the 17th Georgia, then the 20th Georgia, then the 15th Georgia, all intermingled with the 1st Texas, pretty much right in front of the George Weicker triangular field. So actually, at one point, this position is completely surrounded by the Confederates. Now, the 44th Alabama sees an opportunity to rush the Union position and capture Smith's guns from the reverse. They'll separate. The 5 companies will go with Perry of the Colonel Perry of the 44th Alabama. 5 companies will go with Major Carey, George Carey, of the 44th Alabama, in 2 very distinct actions. Again, this Confederate regiment, a little bit further down, going right through Slaughter Pen, going right across Plum Creek, Plum Run, if you will. Perry's men are on the right. These 5 companies will charge into the rocks, the large rocks, and those rocks are being held by the right portion of the 4th Maine and some of the sharpshooters that backed up from the slider. They will do quite a job. They will capture about 40, 45 men in their assault. While they're doing that, the left portion of the 44th Alabama will cross the nose of Devil's Den, that dish of ground that I just showed you, trying to take the rear, or trying to take Smith's guns from the rear. Right? At this point, Smith has already thrown up his hands. All right? He's going to lose those guns. One gun has already been disabled because Confederate artillery had fired at Smith's position before the Confederates even attacked. So he has taken all his implements and most of his men, all of his horses, all of his limbers, back down there where we started our tour. Those are the 2 guns. So he's back down there, and he's packed those those guns with double canister, double charged canister. Now, the 48th Alabama is keeping the 4th Maine pinned down. That's why the 44th Alabama believes they can succeed in this action. As they attack, like I said, the right portion is very successful. They will capture about 40 to 45 men down in the rocks. The left half of the 44th Alabama carries men will go up and over the nose of the hill and are only being kept back by the fire of what's left of the 124th New York. Remember? The orange blossom. At this point that Elijah Walker, like I said, limping around on a very, very bad leg, will give one of the most remarkable orders of the Battle of Gettysburg. He will order his men to abandon their position in front of the 48th Alabama, who are yards away from him, or just in the tree line, if you will. All right? And by the right flank, give a bayonet charge by the right oblique up this hill into the charging 44th Alabama. What I'm saying is these men down here, all right, will turn to their right, will fix bayonets, will turn to their right and charge obliquely in two lines up in this direction, up and over that, right about where the guns, where the carcass placement guns today, and into the 44th Alabama. It's a remarkable action. Taking fire as they go from the 48th Alabama, okay? It is successful. For 5 minutes, they will fight unsupported, driving out the 44th Alabama from threatening from that dish of ground, if you will, the nose, or very close to the nose of Devil's Den, driving them back to the gorge. A remarkable action. Now, while this is going on, go ahead.
48th, when they left in front,
they started moving forward, but what do you think kept them back?
Smith's gun.
Smith's gun to keep them back. But help is on the way. Help is on the way. You have two Union regiments that are going to be sent down here. First, they're going to be sent to 40th New York. This is called the Mozart Regiment. You guys might be able to see it. There's a monument out down there. They will come down the valley past Smith's gun. They will pass Smith's gun, Smith will stop firing, and they will get to that position right there, and then engage the 48th Alabama. Another group will come down the 6th New Jersey. That's right, Gullickson's men there. That monument is right under those trees down there, and it's at that point that Smith is able to withdraw. Alright, so you've got infantry. So they held about 10 minutes. They held the 48th Alabama back. Also, at this point, like I said, the 2nd Georgia is swinging in support of the 44th Alabama, and they take the brunt of many of the ricochets of the canister as they're ricocheting off the rocks as they're coming down the gorge. This is hard ground at the time. Canister on hard ground can go up to 1,000 yards. I wasn't aware of that either until I had to do a piece on artillery for Gettysburg. Gary Gallagher's new book. So these guys are getting chopped down pretty good. I'll show you where they take the fire a little bit later. Anyway, the 48th Alabama was held back because of these two Union regiments, the 40th New York and the 6th New Jersey. Smith is pulling out those two guns now to the base of Big Round Top. And now the 99th Pennsylvania that's been on the right flank of Hobart Morris Brigade has now been sent over here. They take position right about here. They will then charge down in that direction, giving support to the 4th Maine, especially when the Confederates start to attack from all different directions. The 48th start coming across. Well, the 48th actually battled these guys. They don't really charge. The 44th Alabama will, the 2nd Georgia will, the 17th Georgia will, the 20th Georgia will, and the 15th Georgia intermingled with the 1st Texas will, and they will charge and break the Union position here. Now, something else has happened. The 3rd Arkansas has been successful against the right portion of Hobart Ward's brigade. So you have Union soldiers that are retreating out to about where Smith's old position was, or last position was. This position here is being engulfed completely. All right? Time to leave. The 4th Maine was withdrawn. The 99th Pennsylvania covers its withdrawal. All right? Where we are, now ordinarily I'd be telling you this story from where that monument is. We call that Last Stand Hill, if you will, because it was the last stand of the 99th Pennsylvania. In fact, if you let me get my notes, I have something I'll read to you. This is pretty effective, and we did this before, and I'll do it again.
see where it is.
Gary, what about friendly fire from
Always, without a doubt. Without a doubt, I'm sure many of the men of the 4th
and they're shooting over the 40th and over the 6th New Jersey.
Oh, without a doubt. Okay, almost there, guys. All right, now, this is what color bar of the 99th Pennsylvania was a guy named Munson.
Yeah.
For the Congressional Medal of Honor for what he's going to do here. And I'm going to read you something that I think is quite remarkable. It's Munson's own story. Tim Smith, Battlefield guy. You guys probably saw it, Tim, didn't you?
Yes.
He borrowed this book from me and put this in his book on Devil's Den, and it's terrific. It's basically how the colors of the 99th Pennsylvania were saved, how he saved them, and why the monument at the 99th Pennsylvania is placed where it is. And if you haven't read this before, I'm going to read it to you now. Now, like I said, we have a terrible situation here. We have these two Union regiments that are about ready to leave as well. They're holding on as long as they possibly can. In fact, the 6th New Jersey will hold, will cover the retreat of the 40th New York in the open ground in Cumberland Valley. So those guys are already withdrawing. The only two regiments left in the area are the 99th Pennsylvania, who have backed up from their position down near the nose of Devil's Den, back to here, Last Stand Hill, where the monument is. All right, they're fighting as best they possibly can against the crunch of Alabama, Georgia, and Texas troops. The Smith has already withdrawn his guns, all right, and the only other Union regiment in the area is the 6th New Jersey, who's actually waiting for the 99th Pennsylvania to withdraw. But unfortunately, they're getting hit by Confederates that are coming through those woods, because like I said, Hobart Ward's brigade has broken on the right. The 86th New York, the 20th Indiana have withdrawn. You now have the 3rd Arkansas firing down into the right flank of the 6th New Jersey down there. And yet you still have a Union regiment holding on as best they possibly can, trying to cover the retreat of everybody else from this area, the 99th Pennsylvania. Okay. With colors riddled and 11 bullet holes in my clothes, I had survived the whirlwind. I had looked down the throats of thousands of fiery guns, discharged without harm to my person. And now that we were compelled to go away from the den, out of the Hades of fire, and save ourselves and the flag from capture, immediate action and some engineering was required. I had a color guard of 8 corporals, and every man was killed or wounded. The rebels were pouring into our rear in vast numbers on both flanks. General Ward ordered our regiment, or what was left of it, to fall back as quickly as possible. It got a good start, say about 60 feet, before I commenced to fall back myself, because I misunderstood the order, and as several of our men were too badly wounded to leave the field and yet able to load and fire at the enemy from where they fell, the thin line of rebels remaining in our front naturally thought our regiment was lying down waiting for another charge, right up there, right where the monument. I retreated with the flag a few hundred yards in good order, but shortly a shell came whizzing past, then another, and still another, bursting all around me. One struck the ground, tearing it up and bursting right at my feet. I knew not whether friendly or foe. It was probably friendly fire by this time, by the way. Little Round Top has almost been secured at this point. You have Union artillery on top of the hill, halfway down the hill, at the base of Little Round Top, and along the Wheatfield Road. So you have Confederates that are going down as a result of that artillery fire. Confederates call it a Yankee ring of fire. Okay? So it was probably friendly fire that brought down, perfect example, friendly fire of bringing down the color bearer of the 99th Pennsylvania. Stunned by the concussion, I tumbled into the depression it made. And many of our men who looked back and saw me fall reported me dead, Munsell all blown to atoms by a shell and the flag captured. That both the flag and myself were not captured was no fault of mine. There we were for a long time playing possum, and I apparently dead as Julius Caesar. The staff flowed along the surface of the ground in my front, under some rocks and bushes, the flag under my body with my head and shoulders down in the depression, and my feet and legs out as a wounded or dead man would naturally lie, stretched at full length during a battle. I was surrounded by low rocks and bushes, as well as by the rebels, and I dared not move from the position until the coast was clear to the rear. The only thing I feared was that a Johnny might come along and try his bayonet on me to see if I was really dead. Just about that time, the 5th Corps swept down toward me and passed me, driving every Red before it. I jumped up and skedaddled to the rear, where my regiment had formed, quietly fell into line, and unfurled a flag. That's how he saved it. Now, one thing that was not in Tim Smith's book, and something that I found a little bit later, is why the monument was placed where it is. And if you haven't heard this story, this is remarkable. And very few people ever have. This is a very obscure little brochure that was put out by the same man. So it's Heroes of the Color Guard. George Broadbent from Lancaster City, Pennsylvania, young and about 18, tall, slim, lightweight, fair complexion, always kind and gentle, and nicknamed on the account of the lady, as a messmate by the name of Charles Herbster, one of my good and true Pittsburgh recruits, and both were color corporals. Each had a presentiment a few hours before the battle that he was going to be killed in the fight. The lady had fired away nearly all his ammunition at the enemy in our front, and had just asked me what he would do after our last cartridge was gone, when a bullet from the enemy struck him square in the temple right before my eyes, killing him instantly. He fell to the earth, the blood spurting out of the bullet hole over his battle-begrimed face. Charles Herbster saw him fall and was by his side in an instant, took out his handkerchief, wiped the blood from his dead comrade's face, kissed him and said, "Poor lady is dead." On his knees behind the body, Herbster planted himself and again commenced loading and firing at the enemy in close company with George Setley, another one of my color corporals from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. When we were compelled to abandon our position and go to the rear, I tried to get Herbster and Setley to go with us, as they were the only two of the color guard out of 8 not killed or wounded at this time. Nothing could move them. There they were, riveted to the ground, avenging the lives of their comrades. And there we left them. Stetley was frothing at the mouth with excitement and anger, and Herbster taking it as cool as a cucumber. Both were the best shots in the regiment, and both had done great execution that day. The next day, we found Herbster's body laying on the top and squarely across the ladies, and both were completely riddled with bullets. Stetley had been wounded and was taken prisoner, but subsequently died. Eight boys wounded or killed, shot to death, defending the flag of their country at a critical point, at a critical moment. On the second day of July, the 23rd anniversary of the conflict, that would have been in 1886, the surviving members of the 99th Pennsylvania Veteran Volunteers erected and dedicated a beautiful monument to the memory of all its fallen heroes on the exact spot at Devil's Den, where the little band of 8 gave their lives so we might live as a nation. So that's where Stetley and Herbster and the lady's body is found. That's where the monument is planted today. That's why the monument is where it is. That was the last stand of the Union position at Devil's Den. Now these men, the 99th withdrew, they withdrew back behind the 6th New Jersey, and then 6th New Jersey withdrew as well. And the only thing that kept the Confederates from exploiting their advantage here at Devil's Den, they had broken Sickles Front and swing in here and around and behind the Union position is very simple. That Yankee Ring of Fire. You had Rittenhouse's battery up on Little Round Top. 4 guns there, 2 more at the base. You had 2 guns of Gibbs's Ohio battery with 4 more guns at the base. 2 of Smith's guns. You got Walcott's guns. You had Watson's guns. The Confederates called it a Yankee Ring of Fire, and they was probably right. So that artillery fire would keep these Confederates back on the other side of this ridgeline. And they would then work their part.
They can depress
the... Yeah, 660 yards. Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah. Oh, I think so. Yes. And certainly, of course, most of the serious action probably came, or serious artillery came from that direction. Union 5th Corps artillery is coming up. Even Walcott's battery, Union 6th Corps was coming up. As a result, there was enough artillery to keep the Confederates back in this position, drive them back across the ridgeline or over on the other side of the ridgeline. These Confederates, when they started working their way toward the wheat field, which is over to your left, would use the ridgeline to shield them from the fire. So they would work their way down the ridgeline, about where the park road is today. Okay. Any questions?
How long did all this
action take? The action was gone in 45, all of this took place in 45 minutes. From the attack
from the west, Devil's Den by the First Texas, until these men withdrew from this position. You have to understand there's another reason. Most firefights, especially with elements of these regiments fighting continuously, usually ran out of ammunition in about 45 minutes. Now, there's something called jackass cavalry. I don't know if you ever heard the term before. You may have heard if you were with me, but jackass cavalry is, in fact, I know somebody who's writing a book about it. A lot of people are always wondering how these men were resupplied when they had a defensive position, or for that matter, an offensive drive going, how they were then resupplied with ammunition. It was called the jackass cavalry. These were little covered wagons, if you will, pulled by two mules. There's one guy at the reins and one guy out the back. And these guys would tear down a position, never stop. They would wheel around, and the guy in the back would throw out a box of ammunition. That was the jackass cavalry. And the jackass cavalry is just seen on almost every battlefield, and I can show you some instances today. In fact, they did that to Caldwell at least once. No way to resupply this position. So once they started running out of ammunition, these guys were already looking over their shoulders, waiting for or watching for a way out. All right, and that's one of the reasons why the fight didn't last as long as it did. Now, the problem is that this position was compromised, not by anything that we've been discussing yet over here. These Union soldiers fought extremely well in a very good position, with a very defendable position. The reason this position fell apart was simply because Hobart Ward's right regiments ran out of ammunition, and men. I mean, 20th Indiana was absolutely devastated. I think they lost 62% of their men and fought until they lost their last cartridge. They fired their last cartridge. Once the right of Hobart Ward withdrew, all right, behind Smith's guns, then you had Confederates literally on 3.5 sides of these Union soldiers. It was time to go. I don't care how good his position it was. With no artillery, with no ammunition, and no more support, the 99th Pennsylvania held out long enough to cover the retreat of the 4th Maine, and the 6th New Jersey held out especially against those Confederates coming up and over the rise, firing down at them, all right, held out just long enough to get what was left of the 99th PA out of here. The funny part about it is if you read Munson's report, the flag did not precede the regiment out of here. It was the regiment that withdrew, and then those guys, the color company that were in front, followed, and that's why he was shot down, or at least he went down because of the artillery blast. It's an interesting story.
Was Little Round Top secure at this time?
Yeah, at this point, yeah.
Did they withdraw back up there?
Well, the 48th Alabama would have had something to say about it, I suppose. Yeah. Yeah.
That tree line, the tree line was further back.
Yes, it was, about 60 yards.
So it was more open here, so it was
yeah,
more
and the 48th
exposed.
Alabama would have been in the tree line. So at about 60 yards past that tab, about where the 48th Alabama would have been. And then, of course, you've got the Texans, the 4th Texas and the 5th Texas that are advancing up the slopes against Devils, against Little Round Top. So there was no opportunity heading that direction whatsoever. Not only that, I mean, later in the day when we finish this thing up, we'll be discussing the Pennsylvania Reserves charging off of the northern shoulder through Gibbs's battery, taking fire from the Confederates at Devil's Den. No artillery, just taking fire as they're coming across the fields, as the Confederates line this ridge line. So there was no way of retreating in that direction. None at all. Okay, guys. Any other questions about Devil's Den? I want you to know this. It's a very interesting fight, and a great deal of bravery shown by the Unions. These men, you know, Hobart Ward's brigade, although not only was it one of the largest, it was one of the best. I mean, that's one of the reasons he is placed out here. He is the flank of the Union Army at one point on July 2nd, right? Well, not even at one point. He is the flank of the Union Army until Little Round Top is secured by Vincent's brigade and Stephen Reed's brigade.
So, Gary, the wood line then was on that side of that path that goes up.
Yeah, you guys know the battle well enough to know that Bill Frassinito published a book, Journey in Time, which indicates all the photos that were taken in 1863. Alexander Gardner came here. He's a protege of Brady. Brady got all the
the money. Brady got all the accolades, but Gardner did most of the work. And Gardner was looking all over the battlefield on July 5th, 1863, for bodies. He came down here, and sure enough, there were Confederate bodies and Union bodies everywhere. And he put up his camera on this rock right here in front of him, and looked in that direction, and took one of the most remarkable photos of the war. It was called Dead Confederates in Slaughter Pen, where you see about 8 or 9 dead Confederates in and amongst the rocks that you can just barely see now. Just to the right of that little shed to your right. And that's the shot you took. And that was all open. And then you can see behind them that there is a tree line. And that tree line, we estimate about 60 yards. 60 yards all the way around, by the way. So you'd have to cut where you see those evergreen trees near that road heading up toward Little Roundtop. You'd have to cut that back 60 yards as well. Mm-hmm. To the right.
Well, that just gives better perspective to the cannon fire coming down the gorge, because
yes,
it's more open.
Without a doubt.
So they had much longer distance to charge across.
Exactly. I'm going to take you down there, and I'm going to show you where the 2nd Georgia probably received the canister fire, and the gorge that the 44th Alabama came up, where they charged from the left half, you know, Carey's men that came up and over the nose of Devil's Den. It's only a short walk, and we're going to be out of the wind completely. We're going to be in these woods the rest of the day. So I think I don't think anybody's going to be too cold the rest of the day. Now, we should leave the cars where they are, and we can get back to them, though, because we're going to go down and then through that field again. So anybody who has to get back to the cars a little bit later, we can. Okay? But if not, we're going to head in that direction. Okay?
Yep.
Good.
Hey, Gary. When we talked about the U.S. regulars, U.S. regulars fighting in the wheat field, a member in the 155th, said for 2 years the U.S. regulars taught us how to be soldiers. In the wheat field, they taught us how to die like soldiers, which became a member of the 155th.
We're walking back down the park road.
Pardon?
They were basically a support, yeah. The right
towards Devil's Den.
But they took skirmish fire for the next 2 days. Most of their casualties was a result of sniping. It took place from positions just like this here on your left. Sure is. One of the more secure positions on the entire battlefield, by the way. But you guys know what this is, right? I mean, this is, well, it's not really a fake. This guy has been identified by another battlefield guide. His name was Ed. Our battlefield guide's name was Ed Guy, and that's William Langley, Company F, 1st Texas. And if you read this and you know anything about it, his body was found by Alexander Gardner by that rock, right behind that evergreen tree. So that's where our 1st Texas man was found dead. So that was during the first advance against the Orange Blossoms, probably. And then his body was dragged maybe about 90 to 100 feet down here, placed by Alexander Gardner, and then the photograph was taken. So this is not a dead sharpshooter. That's a posed view with a dead man. That's not a sharpshooter's rifle. That's just an NCO.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Of course, as the story goes, you know, Gardner came back here like 4 months later, and to his amazement realized that the burial details did not find the body, and at his own expense had what was left of the skeleton or the remains buried in the National Cemetery the following spring. The Daughters of the Confederacy in 1871 the Daughters of the Confederacy from Texas came up and had their this individual reburied from the Evergreen Cemetery to a cemetery down in Texas. So we have identified him. That's William Langley, First Texas.
This was most likely.
Oh, without a doubt. He would have had something called a bench rifle. Bench rifle means later on. It's 35 pounds heavy. Two men carried it on the march. It was sighted for 1,400 yards. And that's a 660-yard shot to the top of the hill. From a position like this, or one similar, Stephen Weed, the commander of the 155th PA, was the brigade commander. The bullet went through the man's belly button and snapped his backbone. And he went down in a heap on top of the hill. That's about where Rittenhouse's battery is. Of course, the aide, Haslett goes over and see if he can help the general as he's bending over the general. A shot is fired, presumably by the same Confederate sharpshooter, and it nails Haslett in the head and kills him instantly. It's at this point that an aide to Weed comes over and pushes Haslett's body off of the fallen general and says, General, you'll be all right, you'll be all right. It's at that point that General Weed said, no, son, I'm as dead as Julius Caesar. He would be in a few hours. So, like I said, a 660-yard shot for a weapon that was capable of firing 1,400 yards. The man had to wear padding on his right shoulder to fire the gun. It had such a kick. It kicked like a mule. All right, let's get you guys out of the wind. Get you down here and see something that you guys call that.
Gary?
The 44th Alabama advanced up and over this part of Devil's Bend, heading for the leftmost gun of Smith's battery, which would be on that higher ground there. And as they came across here, you could imagine a bayonet charge by the right oblique, you know. 4th Maine coming in fast, but right through about where the battery 4th New York, coming in, hitting them and driving them out. Also, later in the fight, the 99th Pennsylvania would come in. And you know what happens with that car? That car is always there.
I know.
And a part of the 20th Georgia. There were three regiments that claimed capture of Smith's guns. The 1st and the 15th Georgia, or the 1st Texas and the 15th Georgia are hopelessly intermingled. Both of them claimed the capture of the guns.
I thought he got them all out of there, he didn't.
He lost three of them. Mm-hmm. All right. What you're on right now is the old trolley tracks, by the way. So the ground has been altered to some extent, but not that much. When the Georgians would swing in here and start swinging around to their right, trying to gain the Alabamans, you would have been on a position right now about the 17th Georgia. When they were attacking or would attack in that final crunch against the 4th Maine and the 99th Pennsylvania, they would leave from these positions. As you can see, wonderfully defensive positions here, as they would then go up and over the nose, by the way, right here, the nose of Devil's Den. You can see it extends a lot further than a lot of people think. Okay?
Now I'm going to take you down here through the board before we start heading in that direction.
I don't know if it's dry or just frozen.
But thank God it's frozen.
Yeah.
We came in here with the last year and a half ago.
Seven layers of rain.
There we go.
I I've never been down this far.
Yeah, this is about where the neatest spots.
Down
the
Charlie Pass, so we're coming.
This is one of the neatest spots in the battlefield. Yeah, this is Plum Run.
Right, Plum Run.
Well, a lot of people call it Slaughter Pen. Right behind you, if you follow those power lines, that goes to the Weicker. Not the Weicker farm. The Slider farm. All right. So when the Confederates, remember, two Confederate regiments, the 44th and the 48th Alabama, were detached from the Confederate command that were going up and over Big Round Top to attack Little Round Top. They basically used this gorge. They came through this gorge that you see directly behind you, which would have been pretty much open. Some trees, but not too many. They were taking fire from companies A, E, and a part of Company H of the 2nd U.S. Sharpshooters. H was actually on the high ground to their right as they were swinging in here, and taking some pretty severe fire. As Company A and E backed up, they would take position in these rocks and fire down at the 44th and the 48th. Well, basically 44th. 48th Alabama was on their right, further higher on the on our right here, as they swung down. And they are going to go down past, well, they're not going to be in the creek, but they're going to be to our right here, down about where the trolley line was. You can see where the path continues here on our right. That would be pretty much the advance of the 44th and the 48th Alabama, trying to take Smith's guns from the reverse. Now, as they pass this position and start swinging in to confront the Union position in the rocks, on top of the rocks, and a little past the rocks, where the 4th Maine was in the low ground, all right, eventually, when the Georgians would swing around, 2nd Georgia would then advance down the creek itself. And those are the guys, like I said, that would eventually take that canister fire as they swing in to gain the left flank of the 44th Alabama. And like I said, according to Smith, the flag of a Georgia regiment, it had to be the 2nd Georgia, it was the only one that was coming down the ravine, went down under this canister fire 3 straight times. They may not have been the target, but they saw a whole lot of Confederates in this gorge, if you will, and started to fire, keeping the 48th Alabama, to some extent the 44th Alabama, and certainly now the advancing 2nd Georgia back until the 6th New Jersey and the 40th New York had come up and relieve Smith's other or last two guns. I'll bring you down here because, like I said, a lot of people don't get down here very often. The advance, like I said, on a nice day, you can follow this creek all the way. Oh, hello. Oh, whoops. Oops. Be careful.
Oops.
You can actually come down from that direction and make the same advance that the 44th and the 48th Alabama did from the slider. Any questions at this point?
Is there this kind of underbrush here around the...
No, you see photographs. We have photographs. Alexander Gardner took a photo from that rock looking generally in this direction. It's in Frazzanino's book as well. And a lot of people don't know what it is because they're looking into some woods. The woods, the heavier woods are on the hill to the topographer's left, okay? But if you look to the right, you can almost see the open fields of the slider farm way in the distance. So what you see behind you are just scattered trees. In fact, very close to the slider farm was his wheat field. And that's right behind the creek, which is now totally like it is now around here, very, very wooded. So this would have been a reasonably easy advance. As the Confederates were coming down from this direction, the only thing they had to deal with were the U.S. sharpshooters on their right flank, which would have been a part of Company H, and A and E that were backing up in front of them, taking position in these rocks as they did. I could have showed you a few rocks here. You know, carving on these rocks is a whole separate tour. You know, I've given an all-day tour where people take etchings, you know, like when they go into rubbings. There are two rocks here that indicate positions, one by Company F of the 2nd U.S. Sharpshooters, one by Company A of the 2nd U.S. Sharpshooters. I don't think they were done at the time of the battle, but I think these men came back after the war, found the rock that they were firing at the Confederates and kind of doodled on the rock. Those etchings we still have on these rocks. That's a whole different tour. I mean, I've given a whole day tour just on the etchings of Gettysburg, made by soldiers probably, you know. And we've got a couple of them on these rocks here. Okay. So, Like I said, it's only a few feet out of our way, so I figured I'd bring it down here and show you the advance of the 44th Alabama and the 2nd Georgia as they swung around to gain the flank of the 44th Alabama. Okay? Let's go back.
The 44th now,
It swings in like this and confronts basically these rocks.
Okay, yeah.
All right, and then the left portion of it, under the command of Major Perry, will go up and over this portion of the rocks into that low ground, which is right over the nose of the hill, trying to take the guns in the reverse when coming from their right would have been the charge of the 4th Maine.
Is the canister bursting over their heads right here?
Nah, they would have been ricocheting off of the rock.
Oh, I see.
And that would have been, they would have gotten nailed a little bit further down.
Could you just stay here till I come back?
We just rescued him.
Yeah,
we tossed him a life in there.
This would basically be the right flank of the 1st Texas. I just wonder how marshy it would be. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Let's go a little bit further, I think.
Gary, what are you thinking? Our lifetime, you'll see some of these trees taken out?
Yeah, our park, believe it or not, they're actually talking about it.
Well, talking and doing are two different things, aren't they?
Talking and doing are two different things, is right. Well, they found the path. They can, we can. This is really early in the year. You know, we don't generally do any of these things in March.
Be careful. We don't want to carry you out. Oops, excuse me.
Okay, here.
Going up towards the triangular field now.
1 second, ladies and gentlemen. If you remember, I said that after the 1st Texas was driven back, they rallied into some boulders. We'll look around. These are the boulders that these men rallied into. They continue even further to your left. And from these boulders is basically where the 1st Texas would
delivered that devastating volley that, according to the historian of the 124th New York, could bring down about a quarter of the regiment, including Cromwell, who was on his horse. He must have been down. He got wedged in between some of these rocks here somewhere. It was that your major was down, boys, and these Union soldiers rallied to move forward to pick up the body of Cromwell. It would actually break the Confederates from this area and drive them back about 100 yards to what I said was a split rail fence that kind of paralleled the wall coming up. But yeah, well, maybe another 80 or 90 yards in that direction. It was somewhat on an angle, but fairly much parallel to the wall. Okay, come on, let me show you. Give you a Confederate perspective of Texas here, and in fact fairly close to the right flank. A portion of the First Texas, when they advanced on the other side of that wall, which would have been that wall right there. Like I said, William Langley, his body was found on the other side of that wall, the body that was used to be pulled into the Devil's Den photo, a dead Confederate at dead Confederate sharpshooter. As they advanced in this direction, well, the Confederates got about halfway across this field. That's when the 124th North opened up. And they fired in rank. First line fired, stopped the Confederates, and the second line fired. And then the Confederates ran, as the 124th New York indicated, like frightened sheep. When they retreated generally down these slopes. They may have come in more in this direction. They retreated more down in this direction and into that direction, if you will, falling into the rocks that you see behind you, where they rallied and waited for the 124th New York to follow them. At that point, as the New Yorkers got about halfway across the field, well, actually, one indication by a Texan says they're about 60 feet away. I guess we're about 60 feet away from those rocks right now. That's when the New Yorkers were fired upon, and according to the, again, the regimental history of the 124th New York, 25% of the regiment brought down, including Cromwell, who falls off his horse backwards and gets wedged between two rocks. Your guess is as good as mine, with two rocks he got wedged in. But the subsequent charge to retrieve the body of their fallen major would break the Confederates from the rocks, drive them back into the open fields, where they would rally about 100 yards in that direction, with Benning's Georgians coming up. First Texas then would be hopelessly intermingled with the 15th Georgia the rest of the fight. There's one exception. The leftmost company of the First Texas was under the command of a lieutenant by the name, actually a captain by the name of Ben Campbell. That would be Company G. Company G affixed itself to the right flank of the 3rd Arkansas. And Company G would fight in those woods. So you did not have 10 full companies. Actually, you didn't have 10 full companies at all, because one company was out on the skirmish line. I think it was Company I. It was Company I that was on the skirmish line from the 1st Texas. When you were talking about this action here, you're talking about 8 companies going after the 124th New York. One company, Company G, is in those woods. 2 companies are in those woods, because the 1st Texas basically followed the 2nd U.S. sharpshooters, Companies D, C, and G, to a place called the Ledge, which will be our next position. Okay? Alrighty. Any other questions?
Guns in all places. Yeah. Once you move in the right place, it's no big deal. There's trees in here now that weren't going to get rid of them.
Well, cost,
so you can make it look like it is.
It cost, they say it cost about $15,000 an acre to defoliate and turn that acre into from woodline to farm fields. We don't have 2 nickels to rub together sometimes. So unfortunately, we're going to, unless the park gets a specific grant for tree clearing, and is able to get a contractor to come in here and haul away the wood, which would defer the cost to some extent. Well, again, a lot of these monuments were placed here where they thought tourists would best see them rather than as a historically accurate event. They couldn't see bringing the road down along the road here. They also had, at the time, probably had to deal with what the farmer was willing to sell them and where they would place the monument. But like I said, we know that those things are not in the correct place. And also, by coming down here, you can also see why the guns were abandoned. The Confederates got to this wall right behind you. The guns were much to their cars, you realize where the cars are. They're right on the other side of that wall, on your right. What is this thing? I got that in my library too. Yeah?
Books
stink, but the guy who wrote it, I've heard him talk, and you are right. He gives a His talks are actually more complete than the book is.
Yeah, I think so.
Again, one of the best views right here. The first Texas would retreat, basically. Again, remember, they're retreating in this direction for one reason. The Third Arkansas is over here. So they're retreating towards the fort. And these, again, are the rocks that they would rally to. The New Yorkers, the orange blossoms are swinging down here. I have one really fast story about this position here. The first time, I write for Blue and Gray magazine, and one of my best friends is the editor, Dave Roth. And Dave Roth, back in 1988, when he was doing the 125th anniversary editions of the battle, came to the park. At that point, the historian here, her name was Kathy George Harrison, had a great deal more power than she has now. Or she could get away with almost anything, you know. And Dave said, I've always wanted to camp out on the battlefield of Gettysburg. So she thought about it, and said, well, there's one portion of the battlefield that would do for you that nobody ever goes down to see. And she brought him down to this point here. And I spent the night with Dave and his photographers down here. We made a little fire right about where we're standing here. And sure enough, we spent one night down here in the George Biker Triangular Field. It was a great night. It really was. And it was probably the only time in history that anybody camped out on this battlefield. This is absolutely Dave Ross' favorite spot. Whenever he comes visiting the battlefield, he comes down here and he sits down on this stump, he says, and he'll spend a part of the day down here writing and or editing my work, which probably takes him a long time. But there is a spot here. It's good because if you look up there, you can see a monument, and that monument is to Van Horn Ellis, exactly. Remember when the 124th New York made their countercharge, they lost their commandery, they lost their major and their colonel, and they were pulled out of these positions by their men, and when they were pulled out of these positions, they put the two bodies, wrapped them in a blanket, and put them on that rock where the monument stands. When the 124th New York withdrew, like I said, the 124th New York and the 99th Pennsylvania, the 4th Maine, would all withdraw under almost a crossfire scenario. I mean, these Union soldiers on their right, which we're going to be discussing next, the 86th New York, the 20th Indiana, would withdraw before they did. As a result, you got Confederates that were swinging up, still and all. Even in such a crossfire situation, the men of the 124th New York, when they withdrew from this position, pulled their dead commanders with them back behind Smith's guns and then back to the northern shoulder of Little Round Top. They literally wrapped them in blankets and carried them with them. When the 124th New York left this position, after they got shot to pieces in this field, they withdrew back to where that monument is, and that's where they would give cover to Smith's gun. Remember when the 44th Alabama came up and over the nose of the hill, at least half of it, right, under the command of George Carey, I said the only thing that kept them back into the bayonet charge of the 4th Maine was the gunfire from the 124th New York. What they did is that from that position, they went and they entered the guns. And from the guns, which is about where this large evergreen tree stands, it's what about where the right gun of Smith's four guns would have been. From that position, they would have fired down at the charging 44th Alabama. So on their left, the 4th Maine would have come up with the bayonet, struck them, and drove the 44th Alabama back down that slope, down off the nose of Devil's Dam. Everybody understand this action as well as I do? I think so. Where was at the time of the battle? Like I said earlier, though, these woods would not have been as dense as they are today. Generally, in that direction would have been on that high ground. You can make out that the ground is going up, if you will. We're basically in a ravine between two high grounds, the Union position behind us, the Confederate position in front of us. The Timbers Farm is about 300 yards in that direction. It's a big, big drive in that direction. Around the Timbers Farm, you would have had at least three U.S. sharpshooting companies that would have delayed the 3rd Arkansas, and Company I, about 40 men of the 1st Texas that were acting as a skirmish line for these two Confederate regiments as they were pushing in this direction. You'd have Company I, basically, of the 1st Texas with the 3rd Arkansas. Also, you'd have Company G of the 1st Texas, kind of attached to the right flank of the 3rd Arkansas. And as they were pressing, as they broke the Union position, these three companies of sharpshooters up and around the Timbers Farm, they drove those sharpshooters back through past that run right there. That is not Plum Run, by the way. That is Rose Run, R-O-S-E. It's a tributary to Plum Run. And as they did, they would push up, and the Union sharpshooters would then take position on the high ground directly behind you. And that is, of course, what Colonel Manning of the 3rd Arkansas would call the ledge. And that's what we call it here at Gettysburg. We call it the fight for the ledge. U.S. sharpshooters would be in and amongst those rocks, and those would be the first men that would fire at the 3rd Arkansas in these two companies of the 1st Texas, I and G. Now, G would pass from the time they were working their way up. Between about where we are right now and the G Weicker triangular field, we can see it to your left. Okay? It would actually be Ben Campbell would be very instrumental in winning this position for the Confederates eventually. Now, as the sharpshooters get to that position, you have the 86th New York that comes down off of where their monument is along the Park Road, and they take position in these rocks as well. 20th Indiana falls in on their right, a little bit further down, still on high ground, overlooking the ravine. Now, when this action first takes place, if you remember when I was first putting putting the battle line together, I said Hobart's Ward's Brigade was the largest Union brigade here at Gettysburg. The right flank was the 99th Pennsylvania. They didn't start out on last stand here. They started out well with their right resting almost at the wheat field. You look out there, you can see open field beyond. That's the wheat field. And the 99th Pennsylvania's right flank was almost resting in the field. So, you have the 86th New York, basically from about where the 124th New York Orange Blossom Monument is today, up to these rocks. You have the 2nd U.S. sharpshooters, at least three companies. To their right, you would have the 20th Indiana. To their right, you would have the 99th Pennsylvania. 3rd Arkansas is coming into a buzzsaw here. 3rd Arkansas advances, they come across the creek, and they advance against these rocks, and they are shot back. In fact, Manning said they retreated 50 to 75 yards to a creek. Well, the only creek in the area is that one. These men are probably using a creek as a defensive position. Okay? It parallels the Union position along the ledge. They would fight this way for a number of minutes. Unfortunately for the Union position, things are changing. 124th New York shot to pieces. The 4th Maine has now been sunk down. much to the displeasure of Elijah Walker, into the low ground on the other side of Devil's Den, right into Plum Run Valley. Hobart Ward, James Smith, the battery commander, is desperately looking for more support for his guns. So what they do is they call for the 99th Pennsylvania. And the 99th Pennsylvania, one of the reasons why the 3rd Arkansas was not able to take this position initially is because of the 99th Pennsylvania. They were on his flank. Every time the Arkansas troops were making a move against this ledge of rocka that you see here in front of you, their left flank was constantly being bented back as a result of the fire of the 99th Pennsylvania. They were making no headway whatsoever. And like I said, the Manning decided to just retreat at this point back to the creek bed, about 50 to 75 yards away from the Union position, and wait for more support. Now, more support would be on its way. Like I said, this is an in echelon attack. All right. First it was Law's brigade. Then it was Jerome Robertson's brigade. Then it was Henry Benning's brigade. Well, then we got somebody coming up, Anderson's brigade. They're going to come swinging up here, and they're going to be swinging into these woods and giving some support, a lot of support, to the 3rd Arkansas's effort here. Now, what happens here is that when the 99th Pennsylvania is withdrawn from the Union right flank all the way over behind Smith's guns, all right, that area right there is Colonel Wheeler. Colonel Wheeler of the 20th Indiana decides that he needs some flank support. So he will take two companies. Now we're talking about a rather large regiment. We have about 350 men of the 99th Pennsylvania being withdrawn from that position to that position. They're trying to be replaced by two small companies of the 20th Indiana, numbering about 65 to 70 men. This is not going to do. Right. Now they swing out to the exact positions where the 99th Pennsylvania had previously been. But like I said, the Arkansas troops immediately realize that there's not a whole lot of support on the Union right flank against them, or against their own left flank. Also, Anderson's brigade comes sweeping in here. Not five regiments as indicated by the post, by that little sign that we just passed. The 7th Georgia, by the way, is on a flank. They're protecting the Union flank down the Emmitsburg Road. There are four Confederate regiments that are sweeping in here. The 59th, let's see if I got this right, the 11th, 8th, and 9th. That's correct? Yeah. The 11th, 8th, and 9th, Georgia. 59th Georgia will come swinging up on the left of the 3rd Arkansas. And it's at this point these two Confederate regiments now start pushing in that direction against the very depleted 86th New York, who's been firing not only obliquely into the 1st Texas and the Georgia troop 100 yards beyond, but are involved in this fight as well. The 20th Indiana has been fighting almost exclusively on the ledge. The U.S. sharpshooters have withdrawn pretty much out of ammunition at this point and are trying to get out of a bad situation. Because besides, these guys fought on their own hook, meaning that nobody was under command. Nobody commanded the 2nd U.S. sharpshooters. They did what they wanted to do. And when they saw a situation crumbling, you know what the first outfit that withdrew was? The 2nd U.S. sharpshooters. I'm not taking anything away from these incredibly brave men, but they saw a position much better than most of the Union officers did. As a result, the U.S. sharpshooters have now withdrawn from the rocks. The 86th New York, like I said, is almost out of ammunition. The 20th Indiana is trying to keep the 59th Georgia, a brand new large Confederate regiment, at bay as best they possibly can. John Wheeler, I think it's John Wheeler, wait a minute, I mean, I'm right. Stop your little recorders there and I'll get it. The 20th Indiana lost 146 men of its 268 engaged. A bullet struck John Wheeler, boy, what a memory, huh? Colonel John Wheeler in the temple as he rode behind his line, killing him instantly. Lieutenant Colonel William Taylor took command and was wounded almost immediately thereafter. Captain Galbraith takes command and calls for more ammo. Word is sent back, there is no ammo left. I mean, no jackass cavalry in this area. The 20th Indiana fights for the last cartridge before they withdraw. Now, as the 20th Indiana withdraws, the 86th New York is then ordered out by Hobart Ward. They have no support on their right flank. So the 59th Georgia swings up and around, has broken the 20th Indiana a little bit further on. That means that the only thing up here is the 86th New York. The sharpshooters are out of here by now, and the 3rd Arkansas now moves forward. Not only that, but Ben Campbell, who paid for this action, he'll pay for it with his life because he is a casualty. He died shortly thereafter. Company G of the 1st Texas, like I said, not fighting with the 1st Texas, fighting with the 3rd Arkansas, will make their way between where the Park Road is today and the wall of the George Weicker Triangular Field. They'll work their way beyond the flank of the 86th New York, firing back and into the flank and rear of the 86th New York, as again the 3rd Arkansas now makes an attack from the creek bed up this slope, breaking the 86th New York. Well, as a matter of contention, the 86th New York, the Arkansas troops claim that they broke the position and forced them back. The 86th New York claims that they were ordered out because of lack of ammunition and no support on either flank. I'm not so sure about either flank, although Company G did get between the 124th New York and this 86th New York. Either way, these two Union regiments plus the U.S. sharpshooters vacate this position before the fighting in Devil's Den is over. You still have the 4th Maine and the 99th Pennsylvania guarding Smith's guns as best they possibly can. You still have the 40th New York, the Mozart Regiment down in the valley, Plum Run Valley, and the 6th New Jersey trying to hold on the best they possibly can. Now what happens when the 3rd Arkansas, these two companies of the 1st Texas and the 59th Georgia are successful? Do they stop? They do not. They continue on. And what they would do is they would have appeared on that high ground immediately where we first parked, all right, and got out at those two guns, all right, on that high ground to your right. That's where they would have appeared, then firing down at the 6th New Jersey's right flank. 6th New Jersey will bend back its right flank and do the best they possibly can, holding back these Confederate regiments. But we have three more Union regiments. Well, 124th New York is now withdrawing. We only have two more Union regiments down at Devil's Den still fighting. That's the 4th Maine and the 99th Pennsylvania. The 99th holds on until the 4th Maine withdraws. Then they make a final stand where the monument is placed, all right, before they themselves are withdrawn. Then after they pass the 6th New Jersey, the 6th New Jersey is actually the last outfit to withdraw. You know, we get a lot of people from New Jersey, you know, but you have to really hunt for something heroic that they do here. So I know the story of the 6th New Jersey very, very well, because, you know, these poor New Jerseyans are always looking for something they did right here, you know. I mean, the fourth largest contingent of Union soldiers at Gettysburg are from the state of New Jersey, and you literally have to hunt for something heroic they do. Gullickson's men of the 6th New Jersey is the exception. They did a hell of a job holding off all these two Confederate regiments in particular. And right in front of us was Gullickson's men. So some of these Confederates actually came up behind Gullickson's men. Now eventually though, I mean, you would have the U.S. regulars coming up, Burbank and Day, and they would take position on that hillock that was right behind where we got out. If we were looking down those two muzzles, down them, and you look right behind you, you'd see a high hill. We call it Day's Hill. At least that's what we call it now. I mean, it's been called Regulars Hill. It's been called a part of Huck's Ridge. It isn't really a part of Huck's Ridge, but people call it that. And eventually, U.S. regulars would swing up there. Still have the same problem with the 59th Georgia and the 3rd Arkansas. Same problem. The 17th U.S. would bend back their left flank, and the 14th U.S. would bend back their left flank because of the problems that the Confederates have right there. The subject I'm doing for Blue and Gray magazine, I've written the last, I write an issue for them every year, and I've contracted with them for another 4 more years. And then there's one more issue, and then my issue will be coming out in June. The subject is retreat from Sickles Front, just what we're doing now. So we're going to concentrate a great deal on exactly what happens after this position is broken. The stand of the 6th New Jersey, I figure I have to do that, you know, for the damn people coming from New Jersey all the time. And the U.S. regulars, and we got a lot of people that can trace their lineage back to these 11 companies of U.S. regulars that fought here as well. Not a whole lot has been written about them. So this action we'll be doing in much greater detail. Actually, about the same detail. It's just, you know, a quote here, a quote there.
Any other questions? This is an interesting part of the battlefield, and very, very often it is. Well, on a general tour, we don't even discuss this. You know, even when you do a wheat field tour, a lot of people don't start their action in the Rose Woods; they start in the wheat field. But this is actually between and betwixt. You're between the action of Devil's Den, but it's more a part of Devil's Den because it reflects on what actually happens later to two more Union, or actually three more Union regiments, the Orange Blossoms, the 4th Maine, and the 99th PA. Okay? Good. All right. Let's get back on the path.
We're heading back down toward the trolley path. The wheat field is on the right to us. And we're just crossing the second little bridge.
They want to tell you that you're I'm right to the edge. I'm taking my gloves off.
Yeah, it's actually blowing up.
Boy, that's nice.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize this, but this is probably where the first action in the wheat field actually takes place. I do have one map that I really am sorry I didn't produce for you guys. I was told only 5 people were coming anyway, so I would have only made 5 maps anyway. But,
this is one out of Carville. He said he got it.
Oh, we did.
That's what he writes,
huh? Well, in that case, maybe he's right. Just give me 1 second here to find it, and I'll pass it around. Yes. Well, actually, I don't have to pass it around. Why don't I just show you here, laid on the ground here, and show you where we are. The white section is the Union soldiers. The black are the soldiers coming in this direction. Okay. This road right here is that road right there. Okay, so we are looking at it. You've got the best view, okay? That's basically where we are here. This is the creek right here that we're on right now, okay? Now, when the Union position was first established, it was only the Union 3rd Corps out here. And you had Hobart Ward's huge brigade down in Devil's Den and through Hutch Ridge, but especially when the 99th Pennsylvania was withdrawn, be sent to the far left, it left a considerable gap in the Union battle line. The only thing that was between two Union brigades, that of Regis de Trobriand's brigade, which was up on the high ground right over there, and what was left of Hobart Ward's brigade down there was Winslow's guns, 6 Union cannons in the wheat field itself. Now, this was determined at this point that Regis de Trobriand's brigade, there was actually 5 regiments up there. It was actually a pretty big brigade. It consisted of the 3rd and 5th Michigan, the 110th Pennsylvania, the 40th New York, and it was left 4 or 5. 110th Pennsylvania, 5th Michigan, and the 17th Maine. How could I forget the 17th Maine? Anyway, these 5 regiments, 17th Maine was a big outfit too. Anyway, unfortunately, as the action heats up in Devil's Den, the commanders down at Devil's Den are always looking for reinforcements, and they're going to get it in the form of the 6th New Jersey, remember Gullickson's men, and the 40th New York, a part of Regis de Trobriand's command. So almost immediately, Regis de Trobriand is forced to leave let go one-fifth of his brigade. He'll travel across the wheat field, out into the Plum Run, and get to within maybe 100-150 yards of the 48th Alabama, fighting on the slopes of Big Round Top. He'll also have another problem. The next group of Union soldiers is in the Peach Orchard. The Peach Orchard is in that direction, maybe a half a mile. There are no troops between his position here on what is known as the Stony Hill, the high ground that I'm pointing at right now, and the Peach Orchard. So he tries to take care of that problem as well. What he does is he sends the 3rd Michigan and forms him in a skirmish line, a very thin line between his position and the Peach Orchard. So in reality, the man only has 3 regiments. He
is the 5th Michigan, the 110th Pennsylvania, and the 17th Maine. As the action starts heating up, as the 99th Pennsylvania is withdrawn from the corner of the wheat field, so all the way to the far left of Hobart Ward's brigade, getting amongst Smith's guns, this gap has been so remarkably larger now that Bridges de Trobriand tries to cover the gap as best he can with infantry. Also to give support to the action against the ledge, all right, against the, at that point, the 3rd Arkansas. So he will send down his largest regiment, about 350 men of the 17th Maine, and they will take position along the stone wall. The monument is down along the stone wall. We'll be down there a little bit later. They'll also place two more regiments down along this creek. Here, and they're indicated right there by the 5th Michigan and the 110th Pennsylvania. In fact, the 5th Michigan's left flank would be right about where we are right now. All right, the 5th Michigan makes it continue in that direction. And then in the open fields to your right, the Rose Farm fields, would be the right flank of the 110th Pennsylvania. There would be a gap, obviously, between here and that stone wall, filled almost immediately by two more Union regiments being sent down from the Peach Orchard. It just seems like the entire Union 3rd Corps is being pushed to the left in piecemeal fashion as the battle heats up from south to north, or from Devil's Den to this position. We have the 8th New Jersey. This is one of the reasons I don't bring up the 8th New Jersey, but the 8th New Jersey and the 115th Pennsylvania, and they will fill in the gap to my left. You're right, between the middle of the 17th Maine and where are we? The 5th Michigan. Mm-hmm. Right? That's what the map indicates. Almost immediately, like I said though, as Anderson's brigade comes sweeping in here, the 59th Georgia, the rightmost regiment of Anderson's brigade, goes up toward the ledge in that direction and helps out the 3rd Arkansas against the Union positions along the ledge. We have three more very large Confederate regiments that are attacking this position. The 11th Georgia goes almost exclusively at the front of the 17th Maine, further to your right or behind you. Right? You have two more Confederate regiments, the 8th and the 9th regiments, that are advancing from this high ground and through the ravine, literally the same way we came down that path. They will hit the 15th, well, they'll hit the entire line to some extent, but for the most part, the 15th, the 115th Pennsylvania and the 8th New Jersey. Almost immediately, the 8th New Jersey breaks under the pressure and withdraws back in that direction, taking the 115th with them. We have the gap there. The 5th Michigan here, the 110th Michigan there, nothing to our left, and then the 17th Maine.
What is it, the 8th goes through there?
Yes. The 8th Georgia then comes through here. Alright? These two Confederate, these two Union regiments have their own hands full with the 9th.
It's got to be the 9th.
Yes.
There you go. See you, alert. You got it. There you go. I'll tell you what I can do. I'll go in right after our tour, and if anybody wants any of these maps, I'll make a copy for you. Alright? Oh, well, heck, you got the copies.
Yeah.
You make the copies.
Alright.
So we got the 5th. Pennsylvania on their own lookout here, pretty much against the 9th Georgia. 8th Georgia has broken Burling's 8th New Jersey and 115th Pennsylvania, and as a result start moving forward, flanking both Union positions here. These men, the left of the 5th Michigan refuses, bends back, and are able to hold back the charge or the left portion of the 8th Georgia. The 17th Maine has a problem, however. They have to bend back two full companies back along a little fence that went pretty much diagonally through the wheat field. And from there, they fire into the right flank of the charging 8th Georgia. This is the first action along this line. And it holds. And it holds for one reason. Because as this action is taking place, none of these trees here are here at the time of the battle. The 8th Georgia looks across the wheat field, and what they see are about 1,600 men from two Union brigades of Colonel Tilden and Switch's brigade coming across the wheat field. At this point, too many Union soldiers. I mean, these three Union regiments are still holding, and as a result of this presence coming up behind Winslow's guns, Anderson's brigade, or at least these three these three Georgia regiments, the 8th, 9th, and the 11th Georgia, will back up hundreds of yards and take position further and deeper into the woods. Okay? But this was where the first action took place, right where we are right now. And you are literally on the left flank. Okay? A lot of people don't realize that they need to move further down the wheat field. In 1863, there were no trees here. You can look and see the rose farm. There's the rose farm right there. That's what's nice about you guys coming in the wintertime. You could, in summertime, I couldn't point in that direction. You wouldn't see a damn thing. So at least you get something of an idea of the way the land here.
When do the action take place? About 5?
Well, let's see. A little over 5. Because the action in the wheat field would last about 3 hours.
Where do the woods begin?
Yeah, right in front of them. Look where the wall is. Okay, do you see the edge of the wall there? Okay, do you see the edge of the wall there?
Yeah.
It's a straight line. You do it.
So look where
about that hill, I guess, when the woods would have started. Best guess, but we have photographs from the Rose Farm in this direction. And from the backyard of the Rose Farm, you can see those monuments. So all of this is,
and I'd say the stone wall, the 1780s.
Yes. And again, they would refuse the right flank. There's a little flank marker that you can see of another regiment. They would have pulled out at least that far to fire into the right flank of these Georgians that bust through here when the 8th New Jersey took off, taking the 115th with them. We have something called an adopt a position project here where groups like yourself can volunteer to clear the ground, the sapling growth and the smaller growth away from some of these monuments. And I know the group that did the 8th New Jersey monument, which is right behind you. I tell them to clear the behind them. They saw more of that action than they ever did up in front of them.
You guys holding
chains. They weren't too happy with that.
You said this guy's
at the round table. They didn't chuckle.
You said this, the guys holding chainsaws,
right? Yeah. They did about as well a job as the regiment did, so they didn't cut down very much.
Would you explain again, I missed this, why these two regiments left to form the gap?
Basically, Burling wasn't with them, their commander. Burling's command had been pretty much cannibalized. At one point, Burling had five fine regiments. By the time the Confederates attacked the Peach Orchard, he had won. You know, and even then, most people weren't listening to him because nobody was listening to anybody after the Peach Orchard. It was being just overrun by the Mississippians. And poor Burling really had very little to command. The 8th New Jersey was not a new regiment, but it didn't have a very good reputation. It had broken in other places, in other battlefields. And apparently, the 8th made a charge, probably from that high ground directly in front of us. They had the momentum, they're screaming and everything else, and the 8th New Jersey, after they fired one or two volleys, just picked up and withdrew. The 115th Pennsylvania, realizing their gap, there was now a gap that the Confederates could have stormed through, and seeing their sister regiment, if you will, retreating to the rear, retreated with them. And as a result, it wasn't for the left flank of the 5th Michigan refusing and the right flank of the 17th Maine refusing. And had not 1,600 Union soldiers appeared on that crest right behind you, Anderson would have broken his position and these two regiments would have suffered most. I have no doubt the 17th would have probably withdrawn toward the Union strength in that direction, but these two Union regiments would have suffered greatly. Okay? Now I'm going to take you in that direction and then up to that high ground to explain a concept that is very hard to understand. But if you can understand it, you'll understand the entire action. Okay? Any other question? Like I said, it's a very rare spot. And I'd love them to cut down this area. Because it's not, especially in the summertime, it's really not conducive for interpretation at all. But this is the first action that we do. Okay?
Troy Bann Avenue and turning right. 22nd, 118th Pennsylvania Monument.
Is this by Adopta?
Yes, Adopta. Yeah, these guys did a good job. I'll tell you, there's an Ohio group that cleared in front of Gibbs' battery. I mean, it looks like a moonscape. I mean, you give an Ohioan a chainsaw. I mean, it's scorched earth, you know? It really is. Nothing will ever grow again.
I adapted a position over at 145th.
Did you?
Yes. Well, I gotta find out about them.
Okay, well, guys, what happened is, it's very, very simple. As I said, those Union regiments held down there at the creek in the 17th Maine held. When the Georgians withdrew, and those three regiments, the 8th, 9th, and the 11th Georgia, withdrew back up and over that high ground to stay away from the Union buildup here, where you are right now was described, or is described by the Confederate commander, Joseph Kershaw, as the Stony Hill. Now, he didn't call it the Wooded Hill, he called it the Stony Hill. There wasn't a tree up here. I mean, I'm talking about what's behind you. There was something called a spit of woods. That's the exact description in a Union reference by the 118th Pennsylvania. They said they took a position in a spit of wood. There's the 118th Pennsylvania. So there was a wood line right here. Now, I said that one of the reasons why the Confederates withdrew, it's very simple, was because of 1600 Union Soldiers' brigades, Tilden, Lieutenant Colonel Jacob Switzer's brigade, who were coming up here. And what they did is they took position right behind the three Union regiments, the Trobriand's regiment, down along the creek and along the stone wall. So you've got three Union regiments down there near the creek, same positions they held. The 17th Maine has straightened out their line, 350 men minus casualties are now along the stone wall. And now you have two Union brigades, Tilden and Switzer. Facing that direction. That's where the Anderson's brigade was coming from initially, right? They set up in this direction, facing the road alone. Switch's brigade, one of their regiments, forms directly behind Tilden's brigade and still faces in that direction. You have literally three lines of Union soldiers all facing the Rose Farm and the high ground and the ravine of the Rose Woods. Okay? You have two regiments that are facing in that wood line. They are facing toward the peach orchard. That's the peach orchard. You can see the white base of the trees, the peach trees down there. Alrighty. Now, get back to the Confederate attack in echelon. Okay? All of these Union soldiers are facing in that direction. Two small Union regiments are in the wood line facing in that direction. All well and good. Now, you have to understand that this is Barnes. This is General Barnes' command. He commands these two Union brigades. And General Barnes makes a terrible, terrible speech to his men as they assemble in this area. He said, if we are forced to withdraw, we'll be withdrawing back through those trees, back through the wheat field, back to the wheat field road, which is in that direction, about a half mile. You should never have said something like that. You don't say something like that before you go into battle, you know. I mean, it's all well and good to be prepared, but you should be talking about defending a position rather than the eventual retreat. And unfortunately, it gives the impression to most of these men that as soon as they are in a tough situation, to withdraw. All right. Now, getting back to the Confederate advance. Confederates are advancing again. The next Confederate brigade to advance is Joseph Kershaw's brigade. These guys are the fly in the ointment. I mean, these guys do more to break up not only the Union positions in the wheat field, but they also are responsible for breaking up the positions in the peach orchard. Now, if you look down there along that, some of you got a better view than others, but along that fence, that's a stockade fence or a Virginia worm fence, you'll see a line of Union artillery. Basically, most of that was reserve artillery, Henry Hunt's reserve artillery under the command of Freeman McGilvery. There are about 40 guns from along this road and into the peach orchard, if you will. And they're all facing, and they've all been firing at Union, at the Confederate soldiers that have been attacking from that distant tree line, first going up and over Big Round Top to get to Little Round Top, the Confederates talked about attacking Devil's Den. Anderson's brigade has taken fire from every one of those cannons. If they're coming across these open fields and heading into these woods, it's been a problem. Kershaw's brigade is next in line. I don't know if you can see it from here. I don't think you can, but many of you know. Well, I can see it from here. There's a tower, a park tower on West Confederate Avenue. About right where that is where Kershaw's brigade begins their advance. And they will advance. They will advance to some high ground. If you look right behind the Rose Farm here, that high ground right there. As they come up and over that high ground, a portion of Kershaw's brigade is on one side and out of the fire of that Union artillery. The leftmost portion, the 2nd, the 3rd, and the 8th South Carolina, are on the left portion of the ridge line, if you will, taking fire from the Union artillery, especially one particular section. We're talking about two guns of Hart's battery, which is up near a pass. You see where the Park Road is in the Peach Orchard? You see where that last monument is? Just to the right of that, two guns of Hart's battery have been pushed forward. And those guys are firing canister into the Confederates that are coming up and over that high ground. It's at that point that Kershaw's brigade splits in two. You have two Confederate regiments from South Carolina that continue down to the Rose Farm and will attack Tilden's brigade, will attack the Trobriand's brigade from that direction. Yeah, three more. Well, it's two regiments and a battalion. The 3rd South Carolina is not a regiment, it's a battalion. So you have the 2nd and the 8th South Carolina regiments and the 3rd South Carolina battalion. They break away from Kershaw's advance to the Rose Farm, and they swing down across these open fields, and they will overrun those two guns. Hart's gun, Hart's men of that section, 18, about 20 men will drop their implements and head to the rear, trying to get behind the rest of the Union position along the Wheatfield Road. At that point, though, however, after they overrun Hart's battery, that most of the rest of the Union artillery along the road aim their guns at these three Confederate outfits and start firing canister at them. As a result, they give up their attempt to silence any of the Union artillery and start trying to seek the left flank of Kershaw's brigade, their brigade, right? All they're trying to do is trying to gain what they've left after they went after the artillery along the Wheatfield Road and partly overran Hart's positions. As they do, Barnes perceives their movement from the Peach Orchard in this direction toward us as an attack against his right flank and rear. Okay? Easy to see. I mean, in fact, look at the flank markers of the 118th Pennsylvania. That's them right over there. They have already bent back their right flank in response to those men advancing from that direction. That's what properly should have been done. Alright? Instead, Barnes orders his men out. Okay? These men withdraw. Not only are these Confederates advancing in this direction, they're only trying to gain the other two regiments of Kershaw's brigade that are now advancing from that white picket fence across this ravine, hitting the 110th Pennsylvania down here. Right. Well, these 1,600 Union soldiers abandoning their positions, withdrawing back in that direction. Well, when these Confederates would come in like this, all right, where are they? They're behind the 110th Pennsylvania. They're behind the 5th Michigan. And these Union soldiers are very surprised to look behind them to see nothing but Butternut and Gray behind them. And they are in a terrible situation. 5th Michigan, 110th Pennsylvania, are doing the very best they can fighting on two fronts. Front flank. Anderson is now moving forward as well, by the way. So Anderson is pushing in toward the 17th Maine. Alright? The left portion of Anderson is coming in this direction with the right portion of Kershaw's brigade. Then you've got the 2nd, 8th, and 2nd, 8th regiments, 3rd South Carolina battalion advancing in this direction. These men withdraw. We're now on a Confederate position. The Confederates take the Stony Hill behind the Trobriand, literally without firing a shot. These men have to fight for every inch to get out of their position and retreat back across to Winslow's guns, who are there trying to hold back the Confederate onslaught until more Union soldiers can come to their support. Now, People like Till, yes. Barnes went over to a couple of colonels, especially the colonel of 118th Pennsylvania, which is called the Foreign Exchange Regiment, and said, you got to pull yourself out of here. The colonel said, no, sir, all we have to do is refuse our right flank. We're in a good position to hold this ground. In fact, sir, if you look around, he said, this is probably the best position in the entire area. He's right. This is a very strong position. And yet, Barnes says, you have your orders, sir. And grudgingly, protestations or not, I mean, these colonels withdraw from this position and withdraw back across those woods, leaving Trobriand's three regiments to the mercy of Pershaw's brigade and Anderson's brigade, coming in from three different sides. Barnes's last command he ever gives on any battlefield. He will do nothing but push around papers in Washington the rest of the war. Yeah, I think it was Sykes, Mississippi War. Sykes was no one to fool with. And when Sykes finds out what happened here, and that 1,600 men withdrew as a result of two Confederate regiments and a battalion. Sykes would have been about where the George Biker farm is, about where Vincent's brigade starts heading for Little Round Top. George Biker farm is along the end. It's the New Jersey farm. So I hope you understand that concept. And if you don't, there is a map here that I can show you. And I do apologize. This is a tough concept to understand. And but if you can't understand it, believe me, here it is. Here we are, 118th Pennsylvania. You can see what Kershaw is doing, right? Here's the 110th Pennsylvania, 5th Michigan down there. This is the Rose Farm. So part of Kershaw comes through here. Are we looking at it correctly? Yeah, we're looking at it pretty much. There's Hart's guns. So these Confederates take Hart's guns and then come swinging in on the flank, right from there. Tilden, now, these two regiments, believe it or not, when Anderson started his attack, the first mistake Barnes made was that he ordered these two Union regiments that were facing the Peach Orchard over here, so that all the Union regiments were facing in that direction. So when Kershaw's two regiments and battalions swings onto the flank of the 118th, the 118th Pennsylvania doesn't have to be told to refuse the right flank. It's at that point, with no support back here, that Barnes says, we're pulling out of here. And then they withdraw, leaving the 17th Maine to deal with the right of Anderson, and the 110th Pennsylvania, 5th Michigan, to deal with Anderson, Kershaw from the Rose Farm, and these two regiments and battalions. It's amazing they got away at all. That's where the 110th Pennsylvania suffers their highest percentage of losses. Okay. Now these, the 110th Pennsylvania, 5th Michigan, 17th Maine, will make a final stand at Winslow's guns, staying just long enough until Winslow can withdraw. We're going to do that action next.
What happens to the artillery in here?
They stay there. They're there.
How come they aren't doing more damage to these guys?
They are. They're firing. They're firing canister at them. And
this
that's
is
one of the
good
reasons.
Position because of
yes.
artillery.
Yes,
support.
They do have a great deal of support here. But and you can imagine, these Confederates are withdrawing in haste from that position to this position, trying to get out of the artillery fire, which indicates to Barnes that they're charging his flank. All right, and that's when he gives the order to withdraw.
But he's got him between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah,
he's
sure
got him.
Yeah. Oh, this is the last command that he'll ever make on the field of battle. Now he'll be, like I said, pushing around papers with after Doubleday, you know, and people like that after the rest of 63 and through 65, but this is the last field command, last field decision he'll ever make, and rightly so. This is a terrible situation. Even those two Union regiments there would have, even if they stayed where they were, even if they didn't reposition themselves, would have blunted the attack sufficiently. All the 118th Pennsylvania would have had to do is back up through these rocks and hold. We're talking about 1,600 pretty good Union soldiers. This is the same division that Vincent's brigade came out. You know, Vincent's brigade, this division, Barnes' division, had three colonels as their command. before. This is not new to them. And Y. Barnes withdrew the way he did. And like I said early on, gave his men the impression that they were going to withdraw anyway. Let's get out of the wind again. Get back into the wheat field here.
We're coming in the 66th New York Infantry. We're right on the road.
Yeah. Guy who's kneeling behind that the rocks on top of the monument there. That's the 17th Maine. That's their position. In fact, the flank markers that indicate the 17th Maine's positions are about as accurate as any flank markers on the entire battlefield. Now, if you were looking at this, the first action of the wheat field, again, you would have the 17th Maine. They would have their right flank continued further down. You see the flank marker just to the right down there. And then you would have had the 8th New Jersey, 115th Pennsylvania, Rolling Brigade to their right. And then, like I said, it's very hard to interpret unless you're down there. But then you have the 5th Michigan, 110th Pennsylvania. That's what I was trying to describe to you when we were standing in the woods. There was a split rail fence that ran from where was that next monument to the right of the 17th Maine up to the high town, which is Stony Hill. When the 8th New Jersey and 115th Pennsylvania broke, the 17th Maine refused their right two companies along that fence. They were aiming about where we were standing. No. After the 8th, New Jersey, 115th, Pennsylvania withdrew, the only reason why the Confederates did not come into this position was because of Barnes's men, the two brigades coming across, were being seen coming across behind Winslow's guns. There were two guns there, there were six at the time of the battle. And they would continue up in a big position, generally facing Anderson's brigade on the Stony Hill when Kershaw attacks. Now, when Kershaw attacks, Barnes withdraws his men and they withdraw back across these, but behind Winslow's guns, the farthest three riding, which is the Wheatfield Road. Now, we have three regiments that are still left at the stone, at the wall and along the creek. The outfit that had the toughest to get out, of course, was the 110th Pennsylvania, and they lost something like 45% or 50% of their men in the effort, being attacked from literally three different directions. They would withdraw, however, the 110th Pennsylvania, the 5th Michigan, and the 17th Maine, all backed up as a result of this action, and they are running in this direction. You have General Birney. General Birney is the divisional commander of all the Union 3rd Corps in this area, and he is at Winslow's guns. And he's holding up his hands like this, pleading for these three Union regiments to make a stand at his gun. The reason being is, Anderson's men are coming across the wall and are heading toward those guns. Kershaw's brigade, after they broke the Union position, 110th Pennsylvania and the 5th Michigan, Kershaw's brigade, not only is coming through here, but they were working their way up through the trees, all right, trying to swing in and take Winslow's guns on the flank. So there's Birney, with his hands up like this, pleading what's left of the Trobriand. Trobriand has seen two actions at this point. His men are almost out of ammunition. Many of Trobriand's men make a stand along that ridgeline right behind you, in and amongst the guns of Winslow's battery. Many men holding empty rifles, all right? Just so Winslow's guns would have an opportunity to limber up and pull themselves out. Quite a remarkable story. The Trobriand's men do an incredible job, considering what the positions they found themselves in. They do really a remarkable job. I don't think that's even indicated on the map, is it? No. Okay, any questions before we go up to Winslow's guns? Okay, let's go up there. Now, I've got water. He has, no longer Anderson's brigade coming in his front, but Kershaw making his way up through the woods to your right. Just give me a second, I'll find it. By the way, if you're interested, this is my scratching, but here's 118th Pennsylvania. That's basically the way Kershaw attacked. Second South Carolina attacked directly on the flank of the 118th. The 3rd South Carolina, 8th South Carolina literally swung in behind. 7th South Carolina and 15th South Carolina advanced from the Rose Farm. Okay? Damn, look, good looking map, eh? Know who made that map?
You did.
Okay. Alrighty, now this is, you're at Captain Winslow's battery, his name is George Winslow. This is from his OR. This will give you an idea of the stand that he makes here. By direction of Major General Birney, I opened with solid shot, giving but sufficient elevation to clear our own troops in the front, which would have been the 17th Maine, down along the wall. Our line of skirmish, in the direction of the, okay, and in firing in the direction of the heavy musketry, lessening the range as our troops fell back and the enemy advanced. Our line of skirmishers fell back on their supports at the edge of the woods, little if any more than 400 yards from the front of my guns. This line was a weak one and stood fairly well back, but by using shell and K-shot at about 1 degree elevation and from one and one half second fuses, I kept the enemy from advancing from the cover of the woods. One and one half second. That's when they were bursting outside their muscles. A portion of Smith's battery on my left also withdrew to the rear. That was the last section down there to our left. Having no supports, the enemy's advance being within 25 yards of my left. That's Anderson pushing across the wall. All right. And by woods and rocks, I ordered my left section limbered with a view to moving it a short distance to the left and rear. Before this was accomplished, the enemy had advanced into cover of the woods on my right, with Kershaw pushing up in this direction, and was cutting down my men and horses. Having no supports in rear and being exposed to a heavy fire of musketry in front and upon both flanks, I deemed it necessary to withdraw in order to save my guns, which was done by piece and succession from the left. Left was right, if you will. These guns firing cannons through the wood. Several horses were killed and disabled before moving 25 yards. In one instance, it became necessary to use a limber of the caissons to secure the piece. Now that means the tying a wagon to one of these guns to pull them out. The casualties were 10 men wounded and 8 missing, 10 horses killed and disabled. All my pieces could not have been brought off had my men been less brave. It's a heck of a report. You got a pretty good idea of his problems right here. And basically, again, he's doing this with Bernie standing in front here, holding up and trying to stop as many of the Union soldiers as they're retreating back in this direction. And many of the Trobriand's men stood, like I said, with empty rifles, especially many of the 17th Maine. So they've been almost in a constant firefight with Anderson's brigade, even before Anderson and Kershaw advanced together. All right, so it's at this point, however, that something takes place that would have saved Winslow's guns anyway. We have more and more Union soldiers being sent in this direction. This is Caldwell's division, 2nd Corps division. We're talking about 4 brigades advancing on a 3-brigade front. They're going to be coming across the wheat field in this direction. In fact, Winslow probably retreated right through their ranks. Okay. Now you do also have Barnes. Barnes is back there laying down on the other side of the wood. He totally meant to lay down. And they're down on the other side of the on the other side of the road in those woods, if you will. And Caldwell's division, like I said, advancing with 3 brigades in front. That's actually 2.5. I can't even call the Irish Brigade a brigade anymore. They've been so devastated by Antietam and Fredericksburg. They're just something of a large regiment, you might say, that are now advancing, but they're going to do a hell of a job here. This is a remarkable action, and it's a remarkable advance. Now, again, what's happening here is when Kershaw fully assembles his four South Carolina regiments, and his 1 South Carolina battalion, they start working their way up into these woods. They're going through these woods. They're facing the same way I am, and they're moving up into these woods, trying to swing in onto the flank of the Union position that's here and Winslow's guns. They don't get there, but they are in those woods at the time that Caldwell's division advances. You have General Zook's brigade on the right flank. They're going to have to go right over the bodies of Barnes's command, literally stepping over the men that are laying down on the other side of the road, and they will advance across the road and hit the woods right behind you, and go in and hit Kershaw head up, okay, front to front, if you will. The largest regiment's the 140th Pennsylvania. Their men are actually on the other side of that tree line, going across the open fields, heading in that direction. Well, the early casualties here, General Zook is up on his horse. He is killed where that obelisk on him is right there. Well, he's mortally wounded. He died just that evening, in fact. Die the following evening, but he is mortally wounded on that position right there. He is literally on his horse trying to negotiate the fences that were along the road when he is shot off his horse. But 6th Brigade will hit Kershaw's brigade in that direction. Okay? Alright, and then Cross's brigade across the field, is that where the park road is, driving Anderson's brigade back into the woods. Okay? Well, we have another phase to the battle here. We have Cross on our left, Kelly that swings in behind Kershaw, and Zook's brigade, without Zook at this point, now pinching in Kershaw's for 5 regiments in those woods, if you will. Kershaw wrote after the war for Century Magazine that he was never in a hotter position than he was at that point, with the Irish brigade behind him and Zook's brigade pressing him from his front. Now, it's at this point that Kershaw is going to do something very unusual. Like I said, when you're called for, when the Confederates are advancing in echelon, like I said, it's like a wave rolling up upon a beach, one outfit attacks, and another outfit attacks, and another outfit attacks. Up to this point, all Confederate reinforcement has always been on the left of the last brigade moving forward, right? At this this point that Semmes is doing the very same thing. Semmes' brigade, Paul Semmes' brigade, would have been coming in from that direction. Because Shaw, seeing the problems that he has, especially with the Irish brigade behind him, rides out in that direction to Semmes and tells Semmes, do not come up on my left, I need support on my right. Fall in between me and Anderson. Right? So Kershaw is here. Actually, he's going to start retreating back in that direction for the Rose Guard. He wants Semmes to come up in that direction between Kershaw and Anderson. And Semmes complies. Now I'm going to read you something that will be in the Blue and Gray magazine. This letter has been offered to me for $4,000, and I think I'm going to buy it, believe it or not. It's Semmes' last letter that he ever wrote. And you guys are going to enjoy this.
He bought the original.
I don't think so.
For a couple hundred.
For a couple of hundred.
If you
haven't heard this, you might get a kick out of this. This is written on the 23rd of June to his insurance man. That's right. It's a letter of General Semmes to a friend regarding his life insurance policy. I camped on the Shenandoah River near Ashby's Gap, the 23rd of June, 1863. If you do not hear from me to the contrary, renew my policy, it expires the 3rd of July. I notify my wife of the renewal, $863 Confederate. Although it is a heavy tax, still I feel that I ought not to give up the policy under the particular circumstance. God has preserved my health and life up to this present time, but he may see fit to take me from this earth very soon. Indeed, having passed through more than the average number of battles unharmed, I ought not to count on much further immunity. In all the battles in which I have participated, and they are not a few, I have always been much exposed. Officers around me have fallen by my side, and all around me, and still a merciful God has been so kind to bring me this far unscathed. Feeling that any battle may be my last one, that is, whilst I have no presentiment of death, still the peril is so great that I cannot hope to escape much longer. My little hope of heaven will sustain me when all else may fail. I feel this hope to be my strongest support. It gives me courage in battle. Death has no terror for me. However, he now gets in to some very personal aspects of his command. And this is the best part of the letter. This is why I'm willing to pay what I'm willing to pay for. I cannot well quit the Army. If I could, I would have done so long ago. Because of the neglect of the government, ignorantly and without intention, I admit, in not placing me in a position to which I am entitled. I am under commanders of but little ability and have hindered opportunity to do more than simply lead my men in battle. This I have always done and almost invariably in advance of all troops in my immediate vicinity. I have never received an order from a superior after I have become engaged in battle, but have fought on with my little command with no person in command to cooperate with other troops nearby. Now here's the situation. The first time that somebody cooperates with him in battle, somebody's going to be laying in that field mortally wounded. On no less than three important occasions, which I can call to mind, namely at Malvern Hill, at Salem Church, which is the Battle of Chancellorsville, and at Sharpsburg, if cooperation had been secured through the orders of superiors, the enemy would have been completely overthrown and the victories, although decisive, would have been rendered the enemy helpless, culminating in the complete overthrow of the Yankee. On two of these occasions, I sought cooperation repeatedly by sending requests to commanders nearby, but to no avail. They were waiting for further orders. I repeat that after going into battle, I have never received an order from any superior, and I have generally had to go in under a shower of missiles without opportunity of becoming acquainted with the ground, the position of the enemy, etc. I repeat, I would long since have left the Army on account of the great injustice done me in withholding promotion for me, and could have consistently done so. Well, it goes on to basically say that they're expecting a fight this side of the Potomac, north of the Potomac. And all my respects to your family, sincerely, Paul Semmes. It is probably the last letter Paul Semmes writes. And what's really kind of remarkable, and I just alluded to it, is that he is saying in the letter that after an advance began, he never got cooperation from the generals to his left or to his right. Nobody ever seeked out any information what to do after the advance had started.
here's a situation where Kershaw goes back, meets him about 150 yards on the other side, or just west of the Rose Farm, and says, listen, I need cooperation. I don't need you coming up on my left flank. I need you coming up on my right. And as Semmes gives orders and starts pulling his command to the right of Kershaw, that's when a missile from, that's when an artillery shell explodes very close to him. He's wounded in the thigh. It'll become a mortal wound. He'll die in Winchester, Virginia, about 10 days later. And the only time that he actually got cooperation on the battlefield, it actually cost him his life. So that is probably the last letter that Semmes actually wrote. It's certainly the last letter he wrote in Virginia, you know, because that day, the 24th of June, is when they crossed over at the Maryland. So it's quite a remarkable letter. It's all in Semmes's hand. It's been offered to me. It's $4,000, and what comes with it is the letter from the woman who took care of him, and writing his wife that he died. And so, the two letters kind of deal. It's not a hell of a buy, but I just want them so bad. Alrighty, so anyway, Semmes is going to go down. So we're talking about a lot of commanders going down here. Sook is killed there. Cross is killed in North Wood. Donald Cross, as you know, or you may know, predicted his own death. Hancock, just before this advance was made, rode over to Colonel Cross and said, Colonel, this will be the last time you advance troops as a colonel, or the last time engage without a scar on your shoulder. And that's when Cross looked at him and said, no, General, this will be my final battle. It will be an awful day. And sure enough, Cross places a red bandana on his head, puts his hat on top of the bandana, and very shortly thereafter, in this advance, he's heading northward, much further down that the Park Road there, where the 5th New Hampshire Monument is, and we'll be down there a little bit later. He is shot through the belly, and the exit wound is near the spine, and Colonel Cross will die that day. So there's an awful lot of action. There's 6,000 casualties in and around the Wheatfield. And when you hear that number being bantered around, by the way, don't believe that you're looking at 6,000 dead and wounded in this Wheatfield. What you're talking about when you're discussing that action is just slightly in that wood line, near the side of that wood line. I'm not talking about the Peach Orchard now, but on the other side of that wood line, the Rose Woods, the ledge, all right? And everything here on our left, including the Valley of Death. So when you hear people bantering that number around, and you will, all right, 6,000 killed, wounded, and captured, and of course the Wheatfield itself. That's what we're talking about, okay? Not these just 14 acres that we're in right now, okay? Any questions up to this point? So, Kershaw's brigade will get out of their mess, by the way. Zook's brigade, Kelly's brigade are just not strong enough to prevent, or the ambuscade, if you will, is not complete, and Kershaw's brigade will slither away and take position back at the Rose Farm. Kelly and Zook's brigade will then take a position where Tilden and Switzer's brigade were up on the Stony Hill. Unfortunately, there was a difference. Kelly and Zook's brigade combined a total 900 men. Well, how many men were with Barnes? 1,600. So there's 700 men less than should have been up on that position there. So you got Kelly and Zook there. Cross's brigade basically sets up about where the rocks are, to about where that monument is. And they will engage Anderson in a firefight that will quickly deplete Cross's brigade of their ammunition. They'll be withdrawing quite quickly. They come in, they'll fight for about 25 minutes in a firefight. They don't get very close to the enemy. But Anderson's pretty damn close, just on the other side of that stone wall, on that high ground that you see right there, which was probably cut back. They didn't have to fire through the trees. And as a result, this firefight depletes Cross's brigade to some extent, and Cross's brigade will be the first of Caldwell's division to withdraw from the Wheatfield. So when the end comes, eventually, you just have Kelly and Zook up there. Brooks' brigade would be sent in, and we'll get into that a little bit later. They will engage Semmes' brigade, minus Semmes, a little bit further up, about where we started our discussion of the Wheatfield. Okay? Any questions up to this point? And we'll do the final aspect of the battle, about where that monument is down there. That's not only a monument
up to the 148th. Didn't you say you wanted to do the 148th Pennsylvania?
No, the 145th. 145th New York.
Oh, 145th New York. Yeah, why wouldn't you do a Pennsylvania? Anyway, any questions?
Yeah, I have one. Yeah. Let's say Kershaw just comes back and withdraws anyways.
Well, he was, but unfortunately. You see, Zook hit him first. So as a result, he's now mounting his troops in a position to attack Zook. When they look off the right flank and see Kelly coming through these open fields unopposed, heading for their right rear, and that's when he orders his men back.
But
when he goes back,
if Semmes would have come up on his left line in echelon, wouldn't he have gotten those guys in front?
He probably could have, but again, you know, a whole lot of Union soldiers, especially coming in this direction, Cross's brigade is coming here. Brooks' brigade may have been behind Cross, because that's how they'll advance. So, and we're talking about an entire division coming in on his right, okay? If Kershaw is in the woods facing in this direction, if he looks to his right, most of the division is coming in this direction, past his right flank, and he is worried about them swinging up behind and making a gap between him and Anderson. The only way you can really substantiate a good offensive defensive position is a continuous line of your own troops. And I don't think he wanted any gap between him and Anderson. And as a result, that's why he called for Semmes to come up and swing in behind, or to his right, to fall in between him and Anderson, because he didn't think Anderson's troops on the head. There is quite a gap between Kershaw and Anderson, and that's probably why he wants Semmes to swing up on his right and not on his left. He knows more Confederates are coming anyway. Lafford's brigade will be coming in pretty soon, and Benning's brigade is winning in Devil's Den. So they're starting to work their way down in that direction. So you'll have eventually Benning's brigade, Anderson's brigade, Semmes's brigade, Kershaw's brigade, and Lafford's brigade all advancing in here at the same time. We're going to do the last aspect of the wheat field. I think the best spot is right over there. Okay?
Thank you.
We need more time.
It's always very depressing to go home.
Well,
not to go home, but to leave his
land. I did one group for 71 hours, and it's 7 hours a day for 10 straight days, and I had more to tell them. So. But that's including Hanover, and that's including Hunterstown, and Fairfield, and Fortana, saw on the retreat. This is only one of about 30 lucids that I have on notes on almost everything. I mean, this is a summation of a lot of stuff, but I could do 4 hours just on where we were at Winslow's battery. I have that many quotes. The thing that slows a tour down are the quotes. If you're just talking, basically pushing people around, you know, outfits around, then you could do. That's why it's very easy. Well, if you were running short. If it's not 11 o'clock, but it's 9 o'clock now, you know, I'd be reading quotes left, right, sideways there, you know. So that's the easiest way to do it. I mean, you just, it's actually very easy to do a tour like this, because if you've got enough information, you can either add to it or subtract from it. You know, at this point, you're not going to get that many more quotes.
Those are the ones that shorten the length.
Yeah.
You give them a basic
and questions.
Action figure.
And questions, yeah. Now, the reason I stay here is because of a very interesting concept that's now going to take place. This is the last action that's taking place in the wheat field, and I don't even need the book. I do this so often from here. But you're on the positions of the 148th Pennsylvania, but you might as well be on the positions of something called the 10th U.S. The last action in the wheat field deals with the U.S. regulars. Now, As Devil's Den Falls, we have two brigades. We have about 10 or 11 U.S. regular regiments. Now, they're very small in number. They're only about 250 men to a regiment. If that, there are even some that are even under 100. And they will advance from the northern shoulder of Little Round Top across the Run Valley, if you will. And they'll take position on a little hill they can just make out on the other side of these trees. We call it Day's Hill. And they will be in a position where they first take fire from the Confederate achieving success at Devil's Den off of their left flank. Anyway, they were the seventh to the two flanking regiments of Hannibal Day's brigade and Sidney Burbank's brigade of U.S. regulars, the 17th U.S. and the 14th U.S. And they take position, like I said, refusing their left flank against the fire of the Confederates at Devil's Den. They're in that position, if you will. Now, if you look at the situation here, Kershaw's brigade has been pushed back, or at least have retreated back to Rose Farm. And ladies and gentlemen, if you were here looking in this direction in 1863, you'd see the Rose Farm.
All those bridges are shattered. The stone wall is definitely up the stone trail. That's the spot
with the open, okay? Now, you have a brigade back here, and they've been in a firefight across it. Across his monuments, by the way, that you see in a line here.
And they continue as you can see in that direction. This part of the wheat field was open as well.
Okay. We got Cross here that's running out of ammunition. They're going to be withdrawing very, very shortly. We got Killian flipped up there. Back there, you got a reserve brigade that has not fought yet. That's Brooks' brigade. They came in with Caldwell. I saw Caldwell's division was four brigades. They advanced on a three-brigade front. The 4th Brigade was back on the other side of the Wheatfield Road. You have two more Union brigades. You got Barnes' men, right? Tilden and Switzer laying down on the other, right past that last evergreen tree on the other side of this on the other side of the road. It's at this point that Birney comes in. Sykes is here now. Caldwell is here. These generals are all getting together trying to figure out the best way to defend the Wheatfield from any other Confederate attack. It is decided that we got Birney. We have a 3rd Corps commander, divisional commander, goes over to Switzer's brigade, a 5th Corps brigade, bypasses Barnes, right? Goes right over and says, you get your men up and advances down to the stone wall. Okay? So Tilden's brigade will be out there. They'll start running the first chance they get. But Switzer's brigade is now down there. There's three small regiments that take position down there along the stone wall. You got Kelly and Zuck. You got Switzer's brigade. You got two brigades a little bit further on in that direction, U.S. regulars. And you got Brooks' brigade. Now, it's been decided that Brooke is going to now come into the wheat field. All right? Sidney Burbank's brigade of U.S. regulars forward. About where you see the edge of the tree line, the next edge of the tree line, the far edge of the tree line, through and come in here. The idea is that Sidney Burbank's brigade is going to come in here, relieve Cross's brigade, which is now out of ammunition. Okay? Brooks' brigade will fall in on their right, and these two Union brigades will advance and drive Henderson back into the woods. That's the idea. Wheeling his command out into Wheatfield. Brooks' brigade begins charging. Brooks' brigade is 300 yards past Burbank's brigade by the time Burbank takes these positions. Burbank's looking around. He can't figure out what the hell's going on. Right? Brooks' brigade was supposed to stop. These two brigades were starting to move forward against Anderson. But they're not. Brooks' brigade heads in that direction. Where he will run into Semmes' brigade, okay, near the Rose Farm. Brooke is out on his own hook. That's kind of cute, you know, I might use that again. Brooke is out on his own hook, all right, through those woods. He's got about 900 men minus casualties at that point. That's Kelly and Zuck on the high ground, giving him some support, at least to his right flank, okay. They charge right through. Cross's brigade is no longer out here. This is now Sidney Burbank's brigade out here. Okay? Well, now decided that the next brigade of U.S. regulars would be Hannibal Day's brigade, would swing into the right of Mississippi Burbank, and they would do the same thing that they wanted to do with Brook. Advance. As they start moving, however, what they see are Union soldiers streaming through Switch's brigade. That's Semmes has been successful against Brook's brigade. Brook is in full retreat with Semmes right behind it. The reason why the Union soldier are withdrawing, Lennon's brigade is advancing, Anderson's brigade is advancing, Semmes' brigade has broken Brook and is advancing, Kershaw's brigade is advancing, and Wofford's brigade is advancing coming through those woods. Right? It all breaks down. Kelly and Cook are the next to withdraw. They are being engulfed by too many Confederates. They start to withdraw. Day's brigade stays back there along that hill, along a little stone wall that's the edge of these woods. The only brigade out here is now Burbank's brigade. Sidney Burbank, the 2nd, 7th, 10th, 11th, 17th U.S. regulars. In the same line that we see where these monuments now stand. These are not to the U.S. regulars, but they are the positions that were taken by the U.S. regulars. These guys would do a hell of a job. The only thing left in front of them is Switzer's three regiments. The 4th Michigan, 62nd Pennsylvania, 28th Mass, right? The right flank of the second U.S., which is about where that far monument is, has to refuse its right flank against Wofford's brigade. You see, what has happened is that the Peach Orchard has now fallen, and Wofford's brigade has come across unmolested through those open fields on the other side of that tree line, through that tree line, and into the they are now firing. Fighting in a little check mark situation down here, a little V, if you will, as Benning, Anderson, and Semmes, and Kershaw attack them. Alright? The U.S. regulars are waiting to fire at anybody. Of course, the right flank of the U.S. regulars are firing at Wofford. The left flank is firing at Benning and Anderson. But for the most part, you have outfits like the 10th U.S. with their guns like this, waiting for left of it withdraws. Now you may have seen that Treani print fight for the, it's not fight for the colors, but it's that Treani print, the fight for the colors of the 4th Michigan, where Harris Jeffords, yes, that takes place, he is bayoneted right there with that monument with the pointed top, the flat monument with the pointed top, okay? That's where he is bayoneted, that's where the fight for the colors takes place. So what we're talking about is that's how close the action is down there, it's hand to hand down there. Still, the U.S. regulars, most of them, the 7th U.S., the 10th U.S., and the 11th U.S., are basically holding their weapons like this, waiting for Switch's brigade to withdraw through their ranks before they level it at three Confederate brigades heading in that direction. And they do. In fact, there was a man in the 155th, it was the 155th Pennsylvania, that's up on Little Round Top, the U.S. volunteer, and he wrote in his diary that night that U.S. regulars taught him how to be soldiers. U.S. regulars taught the Buffaloes how to be soldiers. In the wheat field, they taught him highlights. That's what they're referring to here. And it's a hell of a stand. Now, the 2nd will pull out, the 7th will pull out, leaving the 10th U.S. The 10th U.S. is the last outfit to withdraw from the wheat field. And you're on their positions right now. This is where they fought. With Benning pushing in, Anderson, Semmes, Kershaw, and Washington. They get shot to pieces. Now they'll withdraw back, and the two U.S. regular brigades will then withdraw back across Plum Run Valley, where Gibbs is battered. You guys have heard that story before. I mean, this is a very orderly withdrawal as they're withdrawing back across the field. And as they're withdrawing, they're loading and they're turning around and firing volleys at the oncoming Confederates. As they turn toward Gibbs' battery, Gibbs has two guns on the higher part of the hill. We're not talking about those guns. We're talking about the four guns that he has at the base of the hill, very close to the Wheatfield Road, where the Wheatfield Road and the slope of Little Round Top meet. Okay? And there's many, many quotes. And many of these Union soldiers, U.S. regulars, but look at Gibbs' men, Gibbs' battery, and sees the batterymen going like this. Get down, get down. Gibbs' guns are filled with double and triple shotted canisters, all right? And those Union soldiers that did see those hand motions hit the ground and seek cover behind all the rocks. Those who did not got a clean in the teeth, as did the following Confederates. Four guns went off with double and triple shots of canister. Wilcox's battery did the same thing, and as a result, it blew back an awful lot of Wofford's and Kershaw's men that were following these U.S. regulars across the valley. Finally, you have five regiments of Pennsylvania Reserves that would also charge down through Gibbs' battery, hit the Confederates about where Wiley Crawford's monument is, the first road we got off on, all right? And at that point, hit them and drive them back. Driving the Confederates back, by the way, to the other side of the wheat field, when night fell that night, the Confederates owned that part of the wheat field, that part, a portion of these trees. The Union soldiers had that portion of the wheat field, and where you see their monuments along this route. Men died within 60 feet of their own lines. I mean, they couldn't get to them. I mean, they sent out ambulances, they sent out band members, you know, to pick up the wounded amongst the dead. And as they were, they're being shot down left, right, and sideways. Men died literally within 60 feet of their own lines. And when it was all over, this entire action that we were talking about took about between 2.5 to 3.5 hours, depending on where you want to start it and where you want to end it. But as I said, about 6,000 dead and wounded and captured as a result. When Sickles moved forward, you know, a lot of people say, well, it acted as a giant buffer or shock absorber to the Union battle line. What we're talking about, ladies and gentlemen, is 16,000 casualties in Sickles' front. That's including Little Round Top, including Devil's Den, Wheatfield, Detroit, the Emmitsburg Road, right up to the clump of trees. That's combined both north and south. Any questions? We're on the other side of the ridge line, I think. No, the Pennsylvania Reserves would make one of the last and great charges at Gettysburg. They would charge the wheat field yet again, heading in that direction. If you were where those guns are, there was a Confederate battery. A lot of people don't know it. There was a Confederate battery right on the road at the high ground. Yeah, and the U.S. regulars Pennsylvania Reserves made a charge at those guns. So, they didn't capture them, but they pulled them out as a result of the charge. And in the accident, they captured about 200 Confederates in the charge.
This is in the morning, July 3rd.
One of the last charges on the week here was a successful Union on the following day on July 3rd. At Almond, and they almost got the charge. We have that's the only indication I can find of any Confederate cannons firing cannons to the Union soldiers in the valley. All right, let's get you out of the wind and start getting back towards cars. One last bit of detail about the stand of the U.S. regulars. This is what you're looking at right here in this general area where the 11th U.S. was. As I said, when the U.S. regulars pulled out of here, the 2nd U.S. broke and withdrew, the 7th U.S. broke and withdrew. Actually, the stand of the 10th U.S., which was a noble stand, actually decimated as a result the 11th U.S. Because once the 10th U.S. went to hand-to-hand combat with the Confederates, finally withdrew. The 11th U.S., still standing to their left, was totally engulfed. I mean, these Confederates just swung in behind them. In fact, even though the 10th U.S. was the last outfit to withdraw from the wheat field, the 11th U.S. suffered greater and killed wounded cattle. Okay? Because of the standard their men on the right. On your left, by the way, yes, is the extent of the Pennsylvania Reserve's positions on July 2nd and July 3rd. That monument on your left marks the spot where the youngest colonel in the entire Union Army at Gettysburg was killed. That's Taylor, exactly. That's where he was killed, right there on your left. The high ground directly in front of you, that's Day's Hill, or U.S. Regulars Hill. It has no other name that I know of. Both Sidney Burbank and Hannibal Day's brigade both started from positions on that hill and moved forward. Also, guys, just for your own knowledge, this is the park's idea, this little glitch here, there, this little angle here. So Hannibal Day's brigade would move forward. So Bankman moved forward to the wall, and he had to count the things that he had to deal with, realized that what he was getting was past him. That's what Napoleon had to, you know what, get the man. And instead of Hannibal Day into the weak field for an attack, he was not going to go on the wall, trying to hold on until the rest of the U.S. regulars could advance for retreat back into the park, and then from here, we would just go back across the valley that you see in front of you to the northern shoulder of Little Round Top, at the base of which was Gibbs's battery. Okay. By the way, they said Hannibal Day was the bravest man in the Union Army. While all was going on somewhere about where we are right now, he was up on his horse, lighting his pipe, but a Confederate shot took the pipe right out of his mouth. Without saying anything, he reached in to a saddlebag, pulled out another pipe, and asked his orderly to give him a light.
A little closer toward the bowl this time, right?
Guys, I want to show you one last thing to emphasize something that I said a little bit earlier. And you can see Gullickson's 6th New Jersey monument down there. There are the guns of last section of flip gun. But I want to show you what happens when there's Gullickson's men down there. Okay, now remember, Gullickson's 6th New Jersey is the last regiment to leave the Devil's Den area. Now they're down there and they've been firing at the 48th Alabama, across the park road in the wood line, which is Big Round Top. When the U.S. sharpshooters, the 86th New York and the 20th Indiana withdraw, or are ordered out or leave because they're out of ammunition, they withdraw back in this direction behind Smith's Battery. As the 3rd Arkansas and 59th Georgia continue their advance after the retreating Union soldiers, they take position on the high ground right there. From that high ground, start firing down into the right flank of Gullickson's men. Gullickson still has fighting in front of him. 99th Pennsylvania, 4th Maine are still engaged near the guns of Smith's guns, pretty close to the nose of Devil's Den. They decide to stand and fight. They refuse the right flank firing up at the Confederates, who have a better position on them. Okay? Also, when Gullickson does withdraw, Sidney Burbank's and Hannibal Day's U.S. regulars advance across the open fields, across the valley, and take position on that high ground that you see directly behind you, taking fire from the same Confederates. Those Union soldiers, Hannibal Day's left flank was the 14th U.S., it refused to meet the fire and fired back. Sidney Burbank, which advances to this stone wall here, like I said, refuses its left flank. In fact, that monument right down there that nobody ever sees is the monument to the 17th U.S., the left flank of Burbanksmen, who now refuse their left flank down along these rocks in that direction, firing up at the 59th Georgia and the 3rd Arkansas. So this is an interesting spot down here. You want to talk about a lot of Union casualties. And I'm not talking about captured. I'm talking about dead or wounded who have been strewn through here. Right? Gullickson's men in the 17th U.S., the 14th U.S., and up there against the 3rd Arkansas, 59th Georgia, and many more of the Georgians as they broke the Union position and started pushing on the other side of the ridgeline toward the wheat field. Fair enough? Good position, like I said. Very few people ever get out. Good enough. That's where we started our tour. And if we had a bus, that's where it would be, and that's where we'd be ending it right now. So we'd have a short walk to our car in that direction. Let's take the roads, it's easy. It really kind of puts it all into perspective. The attrition in these outfits would have reduced them to anywhere between 250 to 650 men. Those are the numbers we use in both. Always remember that a Confederate regiment is larger in size than a Union regiment. A Confederate brigade is larger than a Union brigade. A Confederate division is larger than a Union division. A Confederate corps is larger than a Union corps. Everything the Confederate army is a little bit larger. But they're suffering the same percentage. Yeah.
This is New Hampshire. Bring that rock from New Hampshire, or did they just bring the rock?
No, I just think they're going to come from New Hampshire. Okay. But the shot that killed him, Confederate sharpshooter. And this guy by the name of Phelps, by the way. They call him the Avenger of Cross. He was a sergeant in the 5th New Hampshire. And he sees him kill Cross, or mortally wounds Cross, and runs after the Confederate, who only had one shot in his rifle, you know, and shoots the Confederate in the back and kills him. Phelps, the rest of that day, as they were withdrawing from the position, was also killed. So Cross, the man who killed Cross, and the Avenger of Cross, all die in the Legion. Getting back to your question about numbers, though, a brigade, anywhere from about 800 to a high about 1900.
Why did they come together?
Then you have a problem, you know, what general sits and which one doesn't, you know. These guys are very reluctant in giving up their commands, even if they're small. Colonel Kelly, who is now in command of the Irish Brigade, which can't number more than the entire brigade, more than 450 men, which is the size of a medium-sized regiment in Gettysburg, is very proud of the fact that he commands the Irish Brigade, even if there's only 450 men rather than 2,000. So, yeah, I'll tell you, we read off the same page, but we interpret the information differently in some instances. I'm right, Tim is wrong. Now, Tim is one of the best we got. I'm delighted that he's like a ball of fire, too. He'll go all day, too. And he can go all day, too. Done that, been there. Yeah, me, too. I thought you take enough of us out. You get the whole story. See, what I find interesting to me doesn't always appeal to other battlefield guys or even to other groups. If people like biographical information, well, you got the wrong person to me. I know what these men did from June 30th to July 4th. If these guys drop dead on July 5th, I have no idea. And yet, you know, there are some groups, you know, that just like that biographical information. You know, bringing personalities and characteristics.
I'm curious about what happens to that person.
I'll line you up with somebody. You got more money?
That's why we're going back to work tomorrow, so we can get more money to come back down in 2 months.
I'll line you up with somebody who can really do biographical stuff for you. I really, even in my writing, when I give a biography, you know, it's one paragraph. I forget it as soon as I write it, you know. So, anyway, perfect timing. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it has been a pleasure. I mean, I didn't look forward to doing this when I got up. It was 28 degrees. You guys are great, and thanks for coming down. You guys were very generous.
I brought it.
What's that? No, ma'am, you don't have to do that. I'll just charge for more people. That's all.
Hope your fingers work better than mine.
Okay. I'm part of the piece of it. I got one
yes.
to get out.
Yeah.
You can see it to Jerry, J-E-R-R-Y.
You're as good as I'm good. Looking up all my life. I've been looking down all my life. And this thing is ready to slither down my back of my coat, you know? Jesus.